Welcome back to WGN 720. This is Mark Caro with Chris Jones. We are on the download filling in for the wonderful but absent Justin Kaufman. Hey, Chris Jones. How are you doing?
Good to be back.
Good to be back. I know. It's
festive,
like
festive here.
Happy Thanksgiving.
Studio.
It's Thanksgiving today, and it's, you know, people are out. There are a lot of people at work today, even though it's Thanksgiving. And oh, wait, no. It's a week from today. Thanksgiving's in the air, though.
It feels doesn't it? We're all decorated here in the Showcase Studio on beautiful Michigan Avenue. The lights are lighting. The Apple Store is glistening. The hard laptop.
It smells like stuffing.
Yeah. It's good.
Sounds like stuffing with cranberries in it and maybe a little slivered almonds and that sort of thing. What's your favorite? Are you more of a stuffing or a mashed potatoes person?
I'm both. Stuffing and mashed potatoes, both good with me.
Do you mix them together on the plate or do you keep them separately?
Separate. Totally
do you cook the mashed potatoes in the bird?
No. It's heretical.
The stuffing. The stuffing is what you would cook in the bird. That's why it's called stuffing.
Exactly.
But you're not supposed to do that either, right?
No, well, I mean, you can. I usually do put the stuffing in the bird.
My mother used to. You get a relative, and they're like, you didn't cook that in the bird. You know, I read things about how you're not supposed to do that anymore.
So what's going on? What are we talking about tonight here on the download?
Are you more of a savory or a sweet stuffing kind of guy?
Savory.
We have a lot of stuff to talk about, Chris, aside from stuffing. You and I were both together last night, and we're about to talk about the show that we just saw, which stars, features the songs of the one Jimmy Buffet, as one of the jokes in the show goes. We're going to be talking about a movie that I think we liked, Lady Bird. We're going to be talking about... There's some more apologies today.
Yeah, there's a lot, isn't there? There's a lot of guys just getting into trouble at the present moment. Every day, actually.
You're just afraid to sort of look online now. You're just like, what?
I think I saw four today.
Four apologies.
Four prominent apologies. Right?
Yeah. Well, we'll talk about those too. And Michael Phillips is going to come in.
Oh, there we go.
Because he actually got a screener of the... Speaking of apologies, Louis C.K. movie, I Love You, Daddy, which has since been pulled, and it's going to be, you know...
Never released, so it's a
never not released yet. So he's seen it, and we're going to talk to him, and that's going to be in the 9 o'clock hour. We got my friend Jeff Ruby, who is the or Jeff Michael Ruby, I should call him now that he's a novelist. but he is the one of the longtime dining writers at Chicago Magazine, and also his young adult novel coming out. And actually, he right now, if you're in the neighborhood, he's at Women and Children First now, supposed to go to his book signing, but I couldn't because I'm here. So he's going to come in and talk to us about 10 o'clock. Got some other stuff too. There'll be surprises. There'll be looseness. There will be tightness and thought provoking. Ideas.
All right. Well,
talk about restaurants and what they know about you.
Big data restaurants.
Yeah, big data and restaurants. Is that hospitable? I don't know. We'll find out. But Margaritaville. So Jimmy Buffett.
Well, there you go. So there you have last night the opening of the pre-Broadway tryout of Escape to Margaritaville by Jimmy Buffett. So what that is essentially a jukebox musical, Mamma Mia for Parrotheads, you might say. And what they've done is they've taken, I think there are 28 Jimmy Buffett songs in the show. And, you know, one of the things about Jimmy Buffett is that he has a lot of songs. And if you're a Jimmy Buffett fan, you know a lot of songs. It's not just Cheeseburger in Paradise or Escape to Margaritaville. It's Come Monday. It's a whole slew of 25 or 30 songs that everybody knows. So what they've done is they've put this in a fictional story with a Jimmy Buffett-like figure at the center of the story. One of the things when these big musical stars do jukebox musicals, they always get played by younger versions of themselves.
So
Jimmy, as you know, is a septuagenarian, still going strong. But, you know, the guy, Paul Nolan, who's playing him in the show, is sort of hot looking, 35. He's a guitar strummer on an unspecified Caribbean island. And then what happens in the show is a young woman, a soil scientist, an environmental biologist, arrives at the island, weirdly enough, ends up in this guy's bar. And then the trajectory of the show is basically this. It's like he has to learn that you can't chill out all the time, Mark Caro. If you do that, that is not the way to a happy life. And she has to learn that
chill
now
out.
And again, you gotta
you
chill,
gotta chill out.
Out. And you know what? They meet in the middle. And that is the entertainment.
Didn't see it coming. My 13-year-old daughter, she's telling me what's going to happen. And I'm just like, yeah, okay. It's a musical. Were you charmed by them? I read your review. You can go on ChicagoTribune.com and slash Theater Loop, and you could read Chris Jones's review of it.
Yeah.
It's up now. Were you charmed by them as a couple?
Not particularly. They were okay. I mean, I think, here's what I think in a nutshell. I think Jimmy, I'm a big fan of Jimmy Buffett. So I was at the Wrigley Field concert. Maybe you were.
I was not.
In Radioland.
Oh, you in Radioland.
You in Radioland were there. And if you were there, you got an opinion on Buffett, you can always call us, you know, 981-7200-312.
Yes, or you please can text do. Text us.
Anyway, so I was there and I saw 42,000 people of great diversity of age, ethnicity, everything about it. I think Buffett is kind of a seminal guy, a very, you know, an important, you know, you can argue with me on this, but I think an important 20th century musician, somebody who blended all these different musical styles. And it's really all about, you know, the sort of the consequences of sexual repression in some ways, but also about, you know, he has his origins in sort of folk, protest movement, folk music. And I think that the show has to be more about his music. So I was struck by the fact that nobody in the show really looked at the musicians. Now, if you actually see Jimmy Buffett and the Coral Reef Band, they interact all the time because it's about the music. This is a very sitcom-y show. It's done by two L.A. writers who write sitcoms. And they write them very well. It's quite funny in places. You know, one of the gags was a funny gag, like they were like, the character says, work is a dirty word out here, and if you say it again, we'll have to wash your mouth out with tequila, and everybody in the bar goes, work.
Right. You just know that right away. Welcome back to The Download. This is Mark Caro and Chris Jones to my right, filling in for Justin Kaufman. We're talking about the big pre-Broadway opening last night of Escape to Margaritaville.
What did you think? So what did you think?
I thought that I thought it looked great. I thought the sets were really dazzling and the lighting, and I just sort of felt like you could sort of, if you sort of want to see where what a musical or a stage show can do right now technically with sets and everything else, I thought, wow, that looks really cool. I feel like I'm on the beach now. Oh, now I feel like I'm in cold Cincinnati. And I thought the singing was really good. It was strong. I thought the overall vibe was fun. But I just feel like a musical, your great musicals, your great plays, they're starting with the story and then the music is complementing the story. And here, because you're trying to connect the dots, sometimes very cleverly among all these different Jimmy Buffett songs, the story just doesn't come out being that important or that there's not that much at stake. And I just didn't care about the couple. I you know, you sort of know the outline of what's going to happen with them right from the start. You know what the dynamic is going to be. And I just didn't care if they were together or not. It's nice. It was fine. But I just sort of felt like story-wise, it is connecting the dots a little bit.
Well, you know, the interesting thing about Buffett's music, of course, is that he's a narrative songwriter, right? So many of his songs actually tell a story. Like,
right.
I mean, Come Monday is my favorite of all of them, which is very much, you know, about what it's like when you have a, you know, Monday eventually.
Yeah, and it's a very pretty song, too.
It is a pretty song. And I think that what they do best in the show is that sometimes they use songs in counterintuitive ways. So the most obvious one is the title song.
Right.
Waste, you know, that line.
It's kind of the best scene in the show.
Yeah, it is. And it's because they use the song, The Girl Has Gone, He's Alone, and it's sung as a kind of mournful ballad, which is 180 degrees from your perceptions of that show, which makes you think of Spring Break,
right.
Key West, Drunk People, all of that. And they actually turn it on his head. Now, they don't do that with Cheeseburgers in Paradise, which is a dumb number with a woman who's on a diet. One minute she's at the vegetable tray. The next minute she literally flies.
Yeah, I was going to say, they lift her into the... I laughed at that. My daughter's like, why are you laughing at that? So I'm just laughing that they put wires on her to, like, transport her from the pasta station to the cheeseburger station.
That's a little... It was a little crass. I don't know. I had my issues with that scene. And I also thought that the Cheeseburgers in Paradise, it just... Well, there was a more imaginative way of doing that. These guys are good writers, and there's a lot of, like, Easter eggs in the show. There's this one guy throughout the show, the sort of old pirate figure. He's like, where's my salt shaker?
Right.
And you're like, that's going to pay off.
Right, exactly.
So that's kind of funny. They're sitcom writers.
That's clever.
Very clever. And and if you listen sometimes in the songs, they've come up with an idea for almost every line in every Buffett song. And it takes some doing. They've sat down with these lyrics, and they've really thought it through. But, you know, and Buffett was so, he's a fascinating guy. And I, the thing about him, you know, he's so, his early years were very dominated by Chicago. He said to me in an event I did with him a few months ago, he said that he'd essentially learned how to do his sound at the White Knight on Belmont Avenue. He'd heard Bob Marley right. play there. So he really loves being here.
And he made a reference to it last night when he came out for the curtain
Showed
call
up.
As well.
Bonus concert.
Exactly. As Sting did at the last chip, but that didn't, you know, right?
Yes, he did. Yeah, that's right. Yes,
so,
he did.
But he made a reference to Belmont Avenue. I've come a long way since then. So he's clearly celebrating those roots and everything.
And he's
else.
A big Cubs fan. You know, he's in the Wrigley Field concert. He came out in the empty bleachers and sort of paid tribute to Steve Goodman.
Right.
And that mattered a great deal to him.
There's a lot of goodwill toward that guy. And I was thinking also just in general, how cool is it, aside from what you think of the show, how cool is it of the power of music that you could write a song like Margaritaville, which is just a nice 3-minute song, and that it could like spawn an industry, that there's like the power of people's associations with that piece of music, and then the other pieces of music that he's written. I mean, he's really, you know, there's something really powerful about it, even though it's, I mean, you're a much bigger fan of his than I am. I can't say that I don't go much deeper in his catalog than, you know, the more familiar songs from this show. They're fine. It's just not my thing particularly. But I like Come Monday. That's a nice song. And they're in, and I do just respect the fact that he found something that's connecting with people in a way that you could have a huge Broadway show with it. And we'll see how huge it is, I guess.
Well, he has, you know, I think that we're in need of a shared conversation at this moment here in America, right? And he is able to speak to people on, you know, he's able to speak to people on both sides of the great divides that divide us, you know, and he really is, and he's very inclusive. And I know I sound like a Buffett apologist, but I am a fan of his. I think he's an inclusive guy. I think he's about, you know, he's about, really about his listener's life. He was telling me once how in his concerts, it's all about the rhythm of the audience, that, you know, you've got to bring them up and take them down. And he's a very, very shrewd guy. And his empire, you know, is enormous. My disappointment with this show is simply there was not enough of the soul of Buffett's music in it. And I think it's because they're trying to sell the lifestyle, which is fine, and that's a big part of it. And if there's, you know, any parrot heads out there, I want to argue about this, whether, you know, this is this tension between Buffett as a great musician and Buffett as the sort of the seller of Margaritaville. 312-981-7200, or give us a text.
Right.
And you can argue with us, because that parrot heads are very... I ran into a few last night. They're very dedicated people, Mark.
They are. So here's like your Variety trade magazine question. Is this a Broadway hit?
Well, good question. I was having lunch today with a prominent Broadway producer not connected with this show, and I asked him that question. He goes, "Well, you know, the big question is you're going to get the core Buffett fans,
right?
Which is not necessarily the regular theater going audience. I mean, there was, for example, a longer line at the Men's Room last night than I generally see at most theaters.
Right?
Dudes showed up for that show. Buffett appeals to most, you know, most, both, all genders, and I think that's good, and that it's a known quantity, and he's a genuine star, and he's a boomer, you know, and it's boomers who have the money, it's boomers who go to shows, boomers are the core audience for Broadway. All of that's good. But you've also got to get the musical theater people. That's trickier. And you've got to sort of do okay enough with the critics that you get a pass and they don't say it's a piece of crap and nobody goes. No, you know, no, there's going to be no New Yorker profile about the show declaring it to be brilliant. They all know that. It's not about that. It's about, is it a good time enough? And the problem is that, you know, many of these shows now, there's a lot of jukebox shows. I mean, coming up in Chicago, we've got Cher up next. Cher, the musical, which is going to be really about Cher. Now, you know, because the big thing is interesting, right? You've got two ways you can do it. If you're a big star, you can do either a show about your real life, a la Cher, or a la Buffett, make a fictional version
of
yourself.
Right, yeah, like Mamma Mia or something.
Yeah, looking hot.
Well, let's say we got a caller, Lance. Yeah. Are you a parrot head, Lance?
Yeah, I consider myself one. You're talking about Margaritaville, and I just wanted to mention that Buffett did an interview on 60 Minutes.
Yes.
I'd paraphrase the quote, but you know, he said something like, "I wrote Margaritaville in 20 minutes, and it's paid the rent for a long, long time."
Yes.
Which I thought was a great line.
Right.
But, thanks for taking my call.
Thanks so much for calling up.
That's probably true.
Well, you know, Paul McCartney woke up having dreamt the song yesterday also, and it's still a great song. He dreamt it as Scrambled Eggs, Baby, I Love Your Legs, so he came up with better lyrics for it. But, yeah, just that's just sort of the magical alchemy of music, Chris Jones, or of art.
Well,
right?
as they say in Mad Men, there's this great episode of Mad Men where all the creatives are sitting around doing nothing for like 7 hours, and Don Draper says, that's okay, I pay them for the 5 minutes when they have an idea. And that's exactly right. That's how it works. The rest of us work in stiffs, however.
You know what I just found online is a 1992, October 1992 review I did of Jimmy Buffett's debut novel, Where Is Joe Merchant? So he's been doing his writing for a while.
Too. He has a play, too. He's a prolific guy.
Welcome back to The Download. This is Mark Caro. I'm here with Chris Jones. We're filling in for the wonderful but absent Justin Kaufman. Coming up, we are going to talk a little bit later about the movie Lady Bird, which we quite like. We're going to talk about Al Franken and Kevin Spacey and apologies. We're going to have our good friend Michael Phillips on. We're going to talk about Louis C.K.'s movie, which he has seen, but you will not get the chance to see. We'll also have Jeff Ruby on, the Chicago Magazine dining writer who has a young adult novel out. And he's going to come right from his book event to here. But first, Chris Jones, how much do you want restaurants knowing about you?
That's an interesting question. So my pal Mark Caro here in the December issue of Chicago Magazine, coming soon, now online already, he has a story called Big Data Dining, where everybody knows your name. And let me just set up exactly what's in this story. So if you haven't had the pleasure, let me just lay it out for you. So he's pointing out here that oftentimes, restaurants will know a lot about you. Not, you don't have to be a huge celebrity either when you walk through the door because they've Googled you or they've Facebooked you and they keep notes on your previous visit so that, for example, you might be deemed a huge VIP like Mark Caro himself, no less. No. Or it might be just something more prosaic like she doesn't like straws in her beverage or eats fast or needs quiet or needs particular kind of table. Or you might be labeled a pita, which is a universal
pain
language.
Pain in the
whatever.
Yeah. The British way of saying it.
Or you might be labeled, you know, important editor, alert kitchen, alert kitchen,
right.
Alert kitchen.
Or just doesn't like booths, wants to sit at a freestanding table.
Doesn't like booths, wants to sit at a freestanding table. So, in other words, they have they actually know and think a lot about you. So it seems to me that the issue here is, at what point, Mark Caro, does this go too far? Obviously, it's all right. It's nice to walk in a restaurant where everybody knows your name and they go, oh, it's Chris Jones. Here's his half of Stella, pint of Stella, ideally, sitting right there. That's nice. But Chris Jones was a real jerk last time he was in here. Feels a little icky.
Or it could just simply be, you know, hey, you know, you were in here 2 years ago and they ordered the venison. And, you know, we know that and we want to give you the venison right now. Do you appreciate that because you like the venison at the time? Or are you like, why are you doing that? And also the other thing is that a lot of these restaurants are Googling you. So, you know, it depends on where you're going. I mean, if you're going to TGI Fridays, they will not Google you. But if you're going to a lot of high end restaurants, your Chili's, you know, hey, it's a hospitality thing. So if you go to Grace or Alinea, you know, they're Googling you and they're looking up your Facebook page they're looking to say, hey, you know, they just ran the marathon and they did it in this time or, you know, they have, you know, dogs, these are the names of the dogs or this sort of thing. But also this person really likes architecture and we have an architecture student who's a server. So we're going to pair you just in case something comes up. And so the idea is trying to, you know, personalize your experience to the nth degree using technology, kind of in the way that, you know, you'll go on to Amazon and you'll look up something and all of a sudden on your Facebook page, all that stuff is showing up.
Yes.
And do you appreciate that because they know you're interested in these things? Or are they like, why am I seeing, you know, tube socks when I'm looking for, you know, status updates of my friends?
But isn't this used also to sell you stuff? Like they know Mark Caro likes a good wine. Therefore, he'll spend $100 on a bottle of Pinot. Let's suggest 120 this time to get a little more cash out of it.
Well, see, and that's part of the interesting thing is where these companies are drawing the line on you know, what information they want, because people will collect this information. You could pay companies. OpenTable, a lot of people put their notes on OpenTable. You know, Linea, they use Nick Kokonis's talk system. But there are other systems. There's one called Venga that's mentioned in the story, and they will do reports on sort of the average amount that people spend and what they're spending it on. And like I talked to someone at the Boca Group, which is Boca and, you know, Girl and the Goat and GT Fish and Oyster,
these
and all these
very
fantastic
upscale Chicago restaurants.
Yeah, but approachable upscale, not like at the level of
a linear or something.
But, you know, you can go for a really good night out at Girl and the Goat. And they say we don't want the purchase history on there because it feels like white noise, and it feels like not hospitable. Like, I don't want, just because you ordered a Pinot Noir last time doesn't mean you're gonna want it this time. You might want a Zinfandel with your duck or something like that, or a Syrah, whatever. So they're trying to figure out what the line is of what's useful and what's white noise and what also would seem creepy.
But just for the sake of argument though, you could argue all this hospitality stuff that they talk in the restaurant industry is all ultimately nonsense. Really what they're doing is selling you what they're selling. So you could argue, they might say that, but in reality, what is this being used for but to, you know, to sell?
We are at 312-981-7200. How much do you want restaurants to know about you? Do you want them going on your Facebook page? Do you want them checking out your Instagram? I'm not asking you right now, Chris Jones. I'm asking the listeners out there. 312-981-7200. You may text us. You may call us. Tell us, what do you want them to know about you? Are you okay? Does it help you? I mean, look, if you go into a restaurant and every time you go in, they say still or sparkling, and you say, you know, I want still water, I want tap water, whatever. You know, wouldn't it be nice if they just sort of had that on your little chit to say, he wants still water? We don't have to ask him that every time. You know, we know that this person likes sitting in a booth, so we're not going to, you know, if we have the choice, we'll just put them in a booth and make them happy. And if we make them happy, they'll want to come back. So that's good, right?
I think my answer to that is I prefer that to be done by the human, by the bartender I love, right, who knows, who smiles when Chris Jones walks through the door. Ed at Pedorino's is my number one example
right.
of that. He's like, hey, and he has a nice drink for me. He doesn't need to look up any notes. The moment you keep a record, it starts to sort of shift for me. And what if it's wrong? I mean, did you find when you were writing this that some of the time they're like, oh, yeah, it says Mark Caro is this, and in fact he's not?
Well, it's funny because I was able to see some of the notes that some of these restaurants keep on me. And in the Boca Group, they had different ones, and one of them said I was a VIP and because I was a Tribune editor, which is great because I was never an editor at the Tribune. But, you know, as we all know, writers are more valuable than
Absolutely.
Editors anyway, so it's fine for them, you know, just like they would be more valuable as a writer. But they also had in there that, you know, I've written this profile of Charlie Trotter, as you know, this three-part series, and Charlie Trotter had gotten, you know, mad at me because he didn't like it because it told the truth, and you know, it wasn't even an opinionated piece. There's just a lot of people talking about their experiences, and some people had great experiences and some had less great experiences, and that was all in there. And but I'd gone to an auction after he closed the restaurant for some of his stuff, and there was the preview of it, and he came in and threw me out, and I went and did that social media thing and tweeted it, and so people knew about it. So someone thought that was worth putting in the notes at Belena, saying, you know, wrote series about Trotter, he wasn't pleased and kicked him out of his auction. The woman at Boca, when she saw this, was kind of mortified. She's like, I don't know how this would help anyone serve you. Like,
right.
if, you know, like if a server saw that, they would be like, oh, this guy's Trotter doesn't like this guy.
Well, there's also in this current climate, right, you know, you could have wrong information that can be sort of like, let's say a person X, it says in there, was rude to waiter.
Right.
You can find that can become part of your record. Somebody, you
right.
know, maybe People Magazine calls one day, they look at you, and maybe there's a source that you don't even know about.
Right.
So if you're into kind of the whole liberty thing, the last place you think that people are taking notes on you is some random restaurant that you've maybe not been to that many times.
Welcome back to The Download. This is Mark Caro and Chris Jones on WGN Radio. Somebody's watching you, and it's someone who owns a restaurant or is about to serve you at a restaurant. Chris Jones and I are talking about how much do you want restaurants to know about you? How much big data do you want them collecting about you? Are you comfortable with this? And I'm going to tell you something that is routinely collected on open table that I find interesting, and it's inhibited me, even though it really, I don't think it has that big of an impact. But first I want to share a quote from Alpana Singh, who, you know, runs the boarding house and Tara and Vine and does this master sommelier of Everest and all these other things. And she was using one of these services that collected information, and she finally got rid of it, and she's like, I couldn't take it anymore. It's TMI. It was ruining my Zen to like find out what every review said about this. And Tara and Vine is in Evanston, and it's right by, it's a nice Italian restaurant connected to the movie theater. And she said, you're coming into Tara and Vine to get some meatballs before going to a movie. Do you want us looking at your Facebook page? I'm gonna guess no.
Yeah, that's if you live is Chris Jones, I don't want you on my Facebook page just so because I'm walking into your restaurant. I was surprised, you know, when I read your article about, this is this Chicago Magazine article about this phenomenon of restaurants knowing all these things about you and Googling you and Facebooking you and keeping notes and annotating things and passing right. it around from more than one restaurant because
yeah.
these are shared
if they're a
databases.
Group, yeah, they're big
these
groups.
Are shared databases. It is broader than I thought. I've always, you know, I've always had this sense that if you're Diane Sawyer and you walk into, you know, somewhere in New York, then they're gonna, you know, it's Diane Sawyer, or if they, you're head of a major corporation and people might not know your face, they're gonna keep a note of you. But you're arguing there's a lot of this. Like,
oh yeah,
you listening to us right now, you're probably the average WGN listener. If you go to a lot of restaurants in Chicago, you're probably on one of these lists, right?
Oh, on a bunch of them. Yeah, and if you go to, you know, if you go to one of the, you know, one-off hospitality restaurants, you know, with Blackbird and,
yeah.
you know, Publican and all of those, you know, there you're going to be, you know, collected on those, and it's they're going to have information on you. And one of the things that's collected automatically by OpenTable is like number of reservations you've made, number of cancellations, and number of no-shows.
Yeah.
And I've asked people like, look, if you cancel or you get a hold it against you, would you know, could, and they say no, they all say no. But you know, if you have a lot of cancellations, but sometimes you make plans and you think, oh, I'm just going to sort of book a few different places, and you know, we'll see. I'm going to book one place, but I need to check and see if we could actually make that plan for
yeah.
that day or something like that. And it goes on your record. And somehow, you know, when they hand this chit to your server, they're going to look down and they're going to say, oh, they've made, you know, 10 reservations here, but they've canceled 3 times. And I don't know, I feel like subliminally, like, oh, it's like you've been busted or something like that, even though it's sort of basic information.
Well, the complexity of this now, I think, too, is involving this sort of demand-based pricing. So, for example, in the travel industry, they changed the regulations probably a year or two ago so that airlines could offer different fares to you based on who
right.
you are. So if you're, let's say you're an American frequent flyer like me, and I key in my AAdvantage number, then they're able to offer different prices if, you know, compared to if the airline doesn't know it's me. So what you have to do actually is empty the cache of your browser so that they don't know what it is. And I've tried it and the fares are different. So sometimes them knowing who you are,
really,
they just charge you more. So I mean, that's the, you know, you could see this happening.
Restaurants aren't doing
well,
that
I mean,
yet, but you never know. Talk, I mean, you know, the whole Alinea thing. Sorry to jump in, but the whole Alinea idea is, and Talk with Next, which is where they started it, is you buy tickets for the restaurant and it costs more on Friday night than it does on Wednesday night, or it costs more on Saturday night the most.
But if you take that to its logical extension, let's say you've got a world of virtual menus, so there's no, you know, there's no menu that, you can reprint a menu in a second, you can have a virtual menu, and you can change the prices. You've got Mr. Rich Guy walks in, and you know he's not price sensitive. You can theoretically change the price of the meal based on the income of the person walking in.
Wow.
Now you
yeah.
might be like, that's ridiculous, but hey, that is already happening in a lot of industries. So I mean, that I think, you know, on one hand, the thing you're writing about is kind of benign. Let's, you know, he likes still water, not sparkling, but there's also a bit of a sinister side to it.
Right. Well, this person, Kat Kane, who's a deputy speechwriter, director of speechwriting for New York Mayor de Blasio,
yeah.
wrote a piece in 2015 in Wired, and she wrote, how will restaurants treat diners who they know rarely eat out or can only afford the cheapest dishes
right.
on the menu?
Right.
Will they be relegated
right.
to tables by the kitchen? There's
right.
a real possibility that customer insights could further stratify patrons into haves and have-nots. So that's going in the other direction, which is, you know, if you're kind of like, you don't show up that much and you don't spend that much, it's like, yeah, you're not as important, so maybe you get the seat by the men's room. Thank you very much.
And what about if you're a lousy tipper? And it says right there, Mark Caro does not tip. Then are you, let's say you had a bad day.
Right.
Maybe your paycheck came up a little short that week. Maybe you just forgot. You walk back in there and suddenly there's no service. No one wants to take care of you.
Right. I mean, I will say this, that the benefit of the, you know, from anecdotally speaking to a lot of these chefs and the people at these companies, and also like Carrie Nahabedian from Naha, we had long conversations about this as well. And, you know, they generally say, look, people, sometimes someone has a bad day, you know, but there are, you know, there are some notes where they'll say, you know, oh, this person never pays the valet. Like, you know, there's a valet parker and they just won't pay the valet.
Right.
And, or this person, you know, they have Brandy, which is the restaurant a block away, the French restaurant block away from Naha. And someone will come in and order food from Brandy to be delivered to their table at Naha, which doesn't make any sense at all. So that stuff goes in there and it's kind of funny to read about. But there are these behaviors, but most of them will say at least, and again, this is what they say, that they tend to not record as much of the difficult person notes as they would about the things that make you happy, because they can help you with it, make you happy if you're just sort of a pain. Well, you know, they can win you over with their good service and they like doing that. But, you know, they'd sort of rather give you the benefit of the doubt because they don't want service to be thinking, this person's not, doesn't deserve the top of the line service at our restaurant.
So I'm curious if you're listening to us and you've ever gone into a restaurant and they seem to know who you are, and I'm curious if you like that or didn't like it, you can give us a call, 312-981-7200, or you can text us and just tell us, like, have you ever had that experience, either in Chicago, New York, anywhere else?
I think that people want to be treated as a VIP. I think that they want to be recognized, and I think that the disappointment would be, you know, if they don't. Like, I'm a regular here. And, you know, this applies to, like, you know, the bar or the coffee place that you go to, too. If you go in there a lot of times and they never recognize you, that just sort of feels impersonal. So people want to know, like, how do I become a VIP? And so maybe that's a good sign that they're actually paying attention.
The most profound person ever talked to me about the restaurant business was this woman I ran into. She was an octogenarian New Orleans restaurateur, and I ran into her in a restaurant during the James Beard Awards when they were here last year. And she sort of said two things. She said, number one, what marks a good restaurant is not what they do when they know your name, but what they do when they don't know your name.
Right.
And I thought that was a very smart thing to say. And then the other thing she said was that the name restaurant comes, you know, from restoration, that the whole notion of a restaurant, a really good restaurant, like a good bar for that matter, restores you at the end of the day. So they're really in the business of taking you and your frazzled self and actually restoring you to, you know, human equilibrium, if you like. And those are fundamentally person-to-person qualities that I just worry about, this stuff you're writing about. I see its value to them. I'm less convinced of its value to us, the person walking through the door.
Well, like, you know, I talked to RJ Melman, who's president of Let Us Entertain You, which is a lot of restaurants in Chicago and has for a while.
They
and in other cities too. They do, and he said that they have like a small data department of, you know, maybe a couple people or something like that. But they do look to say, oh, you enjoyed the Nantucket scallops last time you were here, so maybe we'll do that again. You know, maybe you'll order them again. Maybe, you know, it's good for us to know that. Maybe we'll send you an email. But, you know, then Aaron Phillips over at One Off was like, you know, it's just like, I don't really, if I have to choose between having someone looking at data in an office or being down on the floor greeting you, I'd rather have them down on the floor greeting you. So that's the difference. And, you know, Alpana Singh said, even there's a quote that didn't make it into the story. She's like, you know, there's nothing that could beat the owner coming in and saying, thank you for coming in. There is no app for that.
There is no app for that. It's a person-to-person art form, the food business, my friend.
Welcome back to WGN and The Download. In for Justin Kaufman, this is Mark Caro with my good friend Chris Jones.
Hello.
We were just talking about restaurants. We're going to be talking a little bit soon about Al Franken today, the latest apology. Maybe we'll do a little bit of dissecting some of these apologies. We're going to have Michael Phillips, our friend, the film critic at the Tribune, in to talk about some of this stuff, as well as I Love You, Daddy, the Louis C.K. movie that he has seen that none of you will get to see. We're going to talk a little bit about Facebook birthday fundraising. We're going to have Jeff Rubin talking about his new young adult novel, Penelope March is Melting. And we were just talking about what restaurants know about you or should know about you.
My favorite part of, you know, one of my favorite things in your Chicago Magazine article on that very topic was what they write in their notes when it's a food writer.
Right.
Spider.
Oh, there's this whole lingo and all this stuff. Yeah, you're a spider if they think that you might be a food writer. And, you know, it's probably not a bad thing if I had to sort of give like an obnoxious tip to someone who is trying to, you know, get, you know, special treatment or something, I guess they would say, pull out a, well, if when you ask a lot of questions, it depends where you are, because sometimes people that won't pick up on the stuff. But, you know, I guess if you ask a lot of questions and you start taking pictures and you start like writing everything down in a reporter's notebook, that might be the like, oh, pay attention to this person. So if you're trying to get attention, but really the judge of any restaurant should be just how they treat you, whether they know who you are.
Yeah, but any food
or
critic,
not.
Any food critic worth their salt's going to try their best to get salt.
That's
Margaritaville a reference back to Margaritaville.
There are a lot of callbacks on this show. It's going to be really fantastic. We're giving the little Easter eggs. You know, pick up
that's
on this stuff later. But yeah, they know all the stuff about you. And yeah, spider is one.
What are the other funny words?
Well, at Grace, they will call you a TD instead of a VIP. A lot of people don't like VIP because I think if you use the word VIP in the presence of people who aren't VIPs, VIPs, that, you know, could be considered rude. Like, well, wait, I'm not as important as anyone else. So there are a bunch of restaurants that will use the term PPX, which is there's like a French term, which I'm not going to try to pronounce. But PPX is one. At Grace, they'll call you a TD, which is for Tony Danza, which, Michael Muser, the general manager, the, you know, co-partner there, you know, says really there's no reason for it except the TD is just like, it just sounds like code and you don't really know what it is.
Tony Danza is the epitome of
Tony Danza. Yeah, I guess it's, I don't know.
It's a little unlikely.
You could, you know, you could call him up and say, really, Tony Danza? Come on, who's the boss? And, did I even write who's the boss? Anyway, yeah. And, you know, you could, but like, whereas if you were at, you know, Alinea or something, you could be a friend of the Alinea group, so you're a FOGA, F-O-A-G, or F-O-G-A. No, yeah. I'm not saying this wrong.
Right.
So I didn't get
these are all these acronyms.
You could be a FONK. A FONK is a friend of Nick Kokonis, or a friend of Grant Achatz is a FOGA. Friend of the Alinea group is, F-O-A-G. Well, you know, I don't need to do acronyms for everyone here. At Grace also, if you've seen the documentary For Grace that our colleague Kevin Pang made, and you wanted to, you came to the restaurant because of that and you want to get like your picture taken with Curtis Duffy, the chef, you're a Twizzler, because Curtis Duffy likes Twizzlers. So that's what they'll call you there. And
there's this whole hidden world of people with opinions about you these days, isn't there? It's like you can't go anywhere without
your reputation.
What if you make a mistake in life? You can't get it. I mean, it's just
that's a later segment. But yeah, what if you make a mistake?
But
this is meant to be a positive thing.
Yeah, meant to be.
It's meant to be a positive thing. They're just
positive.
They're trying to serve you better and make you happier. And isn't that nice that they're using all the tools at their disposal to do that? I mean, that's what, you know, Michael Muser says at Grace is like, look, if you're going to come in and spend all this money at my restaurant, I owe it to you to find out that, you know, you're a principal in Bolingbrook and that you have these interests and that these are the things that you like. It's my serving you to find out the stuff about you so I know you better and can serve you better. It's not like they're selling that. They're not selling it to Monsanto or something.
So I go for lunch often at the Billy Goat right here under Michigan Avenue, and you know, and they go, and it's I always have a single with cheese every day, a single with cheese, and they always go double cheese is better. And I'm like, look, I come here every day. I have a single with cheese, and they don't change. They're double cheese, and I have to go through this whole and chips, and I mean, it sounds like the cliche, but it happens to me on a regular basis. I'm like, dude, can we drop this? For me, because I come every day and they don't give a darn.
That's where the whole thing isn't about data. It's just about how much they're paying attention, how well the workers are. There are grocery stores that are like this too, supermarkets. Some are very good and some are not. But the ones where you get treated well, the ones where you're going to come back.
Let's go by.
To the download. You're on WGN. This is Mark Caro here with my good friend Chris Jones of the Chicago Tribune. And we are in for Justin Kaufman, who is off tonight. And that is a song that is in a movie that you and I saw recently.
Yeah.
The song's actually by the band Love from 1968. It's an awesome song. I think that song's also in the movie High Fidelity. But to get back to what we're talking about, Chris Jones, What did you think of this movie?
So this is the movie Lady Bird, which is an interesting movie here in Chicago because it is the first movie, here's interesting trivia, the first movie to contain three Steppenwolf Theater ensemble members.
Right.
And that would be Tracy Letts,
Laurie Metcalf,
and Lois Smith. What was the last movie to contain three Steppenwolf ensemble members?
It probably was
the last
not...
mainstream... I'm not talking about documentaries. I'm talking about a real Hollywood movie.
It probably should have been August Osage County, but was not.
But was not. To the cost of the movie. The answer
so like Dirty Rotten Scoundrels or something. No. What would it be?
It was actually...
Something with Malkovich? Of Mice and Men?
Of Mice and Men.
Oh!
Do you know what year that was?
It was like 92 or something.
92, Mark.
Is that true?
Ding, 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 ding,
did
ding.
Did I really get
92,
that right?
Yeah, you really got that right.
Swear to whatever. I did not look that up.
I didn't plan that in advance.
Boy, we did not. So, wow, this is like exciting, spontaneous.
So Lady Bird is this film about a typically complicated 17-year-old girl who lives in Sacramento, and she's played by Saoirse Ronan. And
how do you pronounce her first name?
Saoirse.
Because it looks like Saris, but it's Saoirse, and my wife is always, saying this is what it is, because I'll come up with some other pronunciation this
wrong.
You'd
be wrong, it's Saoirse. Saoirse Ronan, who was in Brooklyn, of course.
Yes.
And also on Broadway in The Crucible, the revival of The Crucible. Anyway,
she's wonderful.
She plays this 17-year-old girl, and it's this coming-of-age story, set as all coming-of-age stories seem to be, in the final year of high school, when, your life turns upside down in two semesters, and you end up going off to college, and, everything turns out to be okay. And the core relationship is between the girl and her mom, who's played by Laurie Metcalf,
right,
in probably the best role Laurie Metcalf has ever been handed in her entire career, and that will probably result, I would have thought, at minimum, in a Oscar nomination.
Well, this is part of what's going on with this movie, Lady Bird, and this is why people are talking about it so much. Because on one hand, it's this very small personal film by Greta Gerwig, who's been in a lot of films as well, and has co-written movies, and she's done movies that are directed by Noam Baumbach, who recently, at least, has been her boyfriend. I don't know what their status is. I don't know them. We're not friends. But she was in, I'm just going to blank on all these Greta Gerwig movies. But she's made all these excellent films. And Frances Ha was one of them that was very good. And she wrote and directed it. And it's a small movie, but people love it, including our friend Michael Phillips, who we'll hear from in a little bit, who gave it 4 stars. And there's a real sense that there have been, the Oscars, because people love the Oscars, and there's been such a shortage of female directors who have been recognized in the Oscars. And there's a shortage of female-directed films that have been recognized. Catherine Bigelow's The Hurt Locker one. But other than that, there's not a lot. And people are really looking at this movie like, this could actually be the best film of the year. This could be the best. And this could win Best Picture. This could win Best Director for Greta Gerwig. It could win, supporting actress for Laurie Metcalf, Saoirse. She could be, she'll probably be up for Best Actress.
Yeah.
Maybe our friend Tracy Letts for supporting as well. He's very good in a sort of understated role. But this is sort of a big little movie, and it also feels like something of the time now, where you have this, female voice coming out, telling this very true to heart story, and it's about growing up and coming of age. I don't know. Could too much be made of it if you start talking about giving all this Oscar hype for it?
Well, any time you go into anything highly hyped, you're always looking for the flaws in it. And it is certainly of a piece with coming-of-age movies in many ways. But there's one scene that I love the best, which is where the girl, Lady Bird, the eponymous character, she's in like an off... No one has any money in this movie, the
right.
characters. And they're in an off-price clothing store. And she comes out, we're wearing this dress, and she looks at her mother and she says... Basically, the mother's like puts her nose up at the dress and she says, can't you just tell me I look nice? And what the movie is saying is that when you're a teenager, you just want to be liked. You don't just want to be loved. You want to be liked, and you want to be sort of appreciated for yourself, even if this is the best you can be. And then there's a shot where the camera lingers on Laurie Metcalf's face, and Laurie Metcalf's character says, "You want me to lie?" And there's something about that moment, because like Laurie Metcalf, in all the years I've been watching her in Chicago, has never lied. She doesn't lie. She's like this rock. She's like incapable of a lie. And it, the thing, you know, you're a parent. You're a parent of daughters, so you know this better than I do. But there's a thing about it where you're like, look, not my job to like you. My job to love you. Not the same thing. Not the same thing.
Yeah, that distinction is made in the movie.
Right.
I've made, those distinctions have been made in my family, you know, growing up, and the one that I'm in, you know, with my kids growing up as well. But yeah, that is in there. You know, how much are being loved and being liked the same thing?
No.
And is being sort of unlikable as a parent a way of showing love? I mean, like that's sort of a lot of this difficult relationship. And it's not one of these kind of cartoonish mother daughter fighting all the time, you know, looking back at my horrible mom story. It's looking back at my really difficult mom who I still appreciate, even though she was a PETA, you know,
right.
She was really difficult, and there were ways that she could have made, you know, my life, this character's life better that she didn't, but it was also coming out of an honest place, which is, you know, the dad's out of work, he's depressed, they have limited resources, and she feels the need to be, to the mom feels the need to be like, this is what the world is about. And the daughter is still young enough to think, yeah, but I dream of doing something somewhere else. And in this case, it's instead of being in, you know, Sacramento where I'm growing up, it's going to New York where all the excitement is.
So we're talking about the movie Lady Bird, which Mark and I think is, you know, really, are you tipping this for the Oscar?
I'm tipping it for a nomination, sure. I do think so. I think that for its quality, which I think is the main thing, because I think that everything gets kind of caught up in the political moment these days. But I do think in the political moment it's well positioned, because it's a really well done story. And these are just the kind, when people look at the kind of stories that aren't being told in Hollywood, they're looking at Lady Bird. Or they're looking at something like Get Out, for that matter. I mean, like, these are the movies that Yes. are going to be recognized at the end of the year, partly because they're saying the truths that people aren't hearing going to the movies otherwise. You're not going to hear it going to Justice League this weekend. You know, there's another movie which I have not seen called Call Me By My Name, and that's supposed to be fantastic also. And again, there's somewhat of a gay love story in there and other, but it's just, and again, I've not seen this movie, but it seems like the stories that have not been told are the ones that are really resonating this year. And that's a great thing. The Big Sick is another one where, you know, it's non-traditional. It's a guy from Pakistan and his relationship, and it's an autobiographical story. These are different kinds of stories, you know, and then you'll have like your big Oscar stuff, like the Paper, right? Or the Post.
Yeah.
The Post.
There's another moment in Lady Bird, the movie, which we've just been talking about for a little while here. There's another moment where you sort of realize that kids never realize. Kids always think about their parents in terms of themselves. They're like, you know, how do I get this from my parent? Does my parent love me? Does my parent like me? This is how kids think. What they don't realize is that as a parent, you are growing old as your kid is growing up, right? So
right.
You've got your own stuff to deal with.
And we don't.
And they just sort of look at you and go,
no.
You know, and I don't think I've ever seen a movie that made that clearer. And there's one gut-wrenching scene in this film, which is small enough, I don't think it'll spoil if I tell you about it. And that's, there's a moment where the Tracy Letts character, who's out of work, he's sort of our age, Mark, and he's sort of, you know, he's...
He looks older, though.
And he's... he does.
He's not, but
and
he looks older.
You know, and even though he's Tracy Letts, he's a very benign, broken sort of character reduced to playing video poker on the machine and he on the computer, and it's kind of a sad, it's like, that's Tracy Letts, that's like manhood has been eviscerated,
right?
Which is another reason this movie is kind of the moment. And it, and there's a moment where he's going out for a job and he comes around the corner and he sees his adopted son going out for the same job,
right?
And it's like, oh, can you imagine that? Oh, on that note,
you listen to their side, now listen to mine. Come think of a story, sure you'll find me sometime. Now pass the blame and unblame me.
Welcome back to The Download. This is Mark Caro with Chris Jones. We are filling in for Justin Kaufman, who is not here today, and it is our honor to be here in his stead.
Yeah.
And we were just talking about Lady Bird and the Oscar movies and all that and what that adds up to. We're also just about to talk to the thing that's been, you know, we have some monitors in here in the WGN Showcase studio out here on Michigan Avenue. And CNN has been on, and I think that they've had something about Al Franken on like the entire time. you and I have been talking, Chris.
Yeah, they have. They keep replaying the same clip.
Yeah. Well, I guess we're going to try to bring something new to that conversation. Just sort of, you know, I'm curious to know, just like, it's at some what point do apologies still matter? Can you accept an apology at this point, or are we sort of beyond that? But I think we wanted to say a few things about Lady Bird still.
Yeah, you know, I just think, you know, I just urge you to go see that if you're looking for a movie this weekend and you're like, especially whoever you are, you can take, you know, a teenager to it. Anyone, I think, 14, 15 or above would enjoy it. I just think, and it's a fascinating movie. It's a beautiful movie. It's kind of a lovely piece of film, I think. And the work of Laurie Metcalf, who in this film is really exquisite. And I'm writing about her career in the Tribune on Sunday, actually, and about this idea that she's this sort of great Chicago actress who represents honesty and truth.
Right.
And also about how she's really good at playing characters that can't change. And the mother, this is a coming of age story with a, you know, fundamentally a mother-daughter movie. And the mother can't change. She's like Inspector Javert in Les Miserables. That the moment she says, no, I like you and I'm going to be your friend and not your mom, her whole world comes crashing down. And it's like you were saying earlier, it's a very small movie, but it does encapsulate really big themes.
And it really sticks with you too. Just the way her face sets.
Right.
And again, and it's not...
No one can set a face like Laurie Metcalf.
No, but it's not caricatured, and you don't hate any of these characters. You don't hate any of them. You know, you'll get upset with probably all of them at some point, but you don't hate any of them. And the adversarial, sometimes adversarial relationship between the mother and daughter is still seen in this loving way, just in terms of this is what life is about, and life has conflict and ugly parts and discomfort. And, you know, as you mentioned at the top of, when we started talking about this, the fact that you have these three great Steppenwolf actors in it. I mean, Lois Smith kind of steals it in her scenes. She's a nun.
Right.
And, you know, she's a nun at this strict, you know, Catholic school that, you know, the girl really doesn't want to be at. And it's just like this is what she's trying to break away from. And they could have made the nuns, you know, your terror nuns and stuff.
Right.
And instead, you know, she's a very human nun. And you're also, there's Lois Smith, and, you know, her, you know, she's connected with Tracy Letts. And so it's kind of, you know, for Chicagoans in particular, it's like this little extra treat. It's a story of Pasadena aspiring to be New York, but in between there are all these great Chicago people bringing it to life.
And in fact, Lois Smith, you know, Lois Smith is kind of having a moment, because there's another movie that she's in this fall called Marjorie Prime, which is it's not yet open in Chicago. There's a screening on Monday. And, you know, here you have just another phenomenal Steppenwolf actress.
Right.
And, you know, I always think of her as Sookie's grandmother on True Blood. Do you remember that?
Right.
The first season.
and you think of Roseanne and Laurie Metcalf.
Yeah,
too,
you but. Do. And but when you watch this movie with Laurie Metcalf, you go, you were not necessarily well served by Roseanne. It stuck her in that sort of comic pigeonhole.
Right.
And she's a fine, fine, fine dramatic actress. This is the first time. I mean, would you say she's ever done a role anything like this? Can you think of
No, anything? Not that I can think of. But I also think that she's sort of someone who makes every role seem like she's never done it before.
Yeah,
I mean,
right.
I mean, you and I saw an insane play that she starred in.
Terrible.
When they opened that, you know, the new Steppenwolf, you know.
Terrible.
But it was crazy terrible. It wasn't even just sort of like, I mean, it was like, it was Laurie Metcalf starring in this piece that was a comic and over the top, and it didn't work. But you sort of had to almost admire, like, there's, you know, Laurie Metcalf could just sort of cruise on those laurels and do just, but she was just like, she's just out there in this thing, and it didn't work at all.
It was truly terrible.
It was painful. And Laurie Metcalf was like, she, and, you know, I hope she wins the Oscar, you know, for supporting actress for this. But everyone has a career, and your career can include these, you know, these plays that not that many people see that really don't work, and, you know, more power to you, right?
Well, you know, it's great when your brand is truth, right? What is great acting ultimately is truth-telling. And the thing about Laurie, and really about Steppenwolf, that's their brand and always has been, and, you know, they don't always live up to it, but when they do, no one tells the truth, like, more clearly than they do. And Lady Bird's stocked with, it's produced by Scott Rudin, who's a New York-based producer of film and theater, and it's very much a film that's stocked with New York theater people. Saoirse Ronan has been in The Crucible on Broadway, and of course the movie Brooklyn. And it's, you know, Tracy Letts, Laurie Metcalf. It's really something about this film that is particularly Chicago and what Chicago does. And, you know, a reminder, I suppose, that Greta Gerwig now has hit the big time, right? I mean, this is like a moment now. She's a major.
And she's not even in the film. She just wrote it, and she did a terrific job with it.
It's funny, at one point in the film they go, the film is set in Sacramento, and at one point they go, Sacramento, it's the Midwest of California. Which I was like, vaguely insulting.
Yeah, they got a little bit of a titter in the audience. The Midwest of California.
The Midwest of California. And there are all these sort of loving shots of this fundamentally ugly city. But, you know, but then of course,
I didn't realize that Sacramento was like such a, you know.
A pit?
Yeah, I was going to say pit, but then, no, I don't want to see
it. But
no wonder their basketball teams are always bad. They don't want to be there.
But, of course, the town you grow up in, you know, it's still home, right? And it's something about the image of the town. It reminds me of those movies that are often set in, like, upstate New York in these sort of depressing towns.
Right.
You know, usually with Philip Seymour Hoffman or something like that. And this one is just kind of the same, but it has this kind of California vibe. I mean, it's an amazing film. You know, and a lot of the reviews of this, and I think rightly, have sort of said, it's a perfect film. Like, people are calling it, for what it is, kind of a perfect film.
Yeah, and also Lucas Hedges is in it, who is in Manchester by the Sea. He's got a very good role in this, and he has a wonderful scene. I'm not going to, no spoilers on that, but he's got one really great scene where they're sort of talking outside the door of that. I won't get into it. but you know, and he was in Manchester by the Sea last year. I think that in general, one of the interesting things that's happened, and you and I have discussed this before, is that the Oscars, in terms of film, have gotten better because the studios are so interested in making the Justice Leagues that they aren't as invested in kind of thrusting their not so great prestige movies on the voters.
Right.
And you don't, you certainly won't, you know, even like you used to have Miramax funded by Disney when Harvey Weinstein was the pre-scandalized Harvey Weinstein, but also when he was pre-Weinstein Company and Miramax. And they also just like campaign these movies, and you'd have these movies that really weren't that good that would get nominated even when there were only five movies up. And last year, I felt like your critics' top 5 movies, 10 movies, and then the movies that were nominated for Best Picture, they really weren't that far off. It felt like last year felt like the closest I've ever seen to the best movies of the year actually being the ones. I mean, the fact that it was Moonlight or La La Land or Manchester by the Sea or Hell or High Water, any of those, like, those were all really fine films. And, you know, the fact that people now are talking about, is it going to be Lady Bird, or is it going to be, you know, Call Me By Your Name. I'm going to get their name on that wrong. I haven't seen it yet. The Post, we'll see. That's like the big prestige thing. Yeah. We'll see how it is. But, you know, a lot of these, I mean, people are wondering, you know, does Get Out get nominated, which is sort of a horror genre thing.
Right.
But it also is really talking about what our times are about. And I think in general right now, people are so engaged in, they want things to be relevant and they want movies to be about what it's like to live right now. And we're like in a crazy time where, as I've mentioned before, like you look on Twitter or online every day and you're like, okay, what just happened?
Right.
You know, since I've been talking to you, I'm afraid to look at Twitter to see what's been going on. Welcome back to WGN Radio. This is Mark Caro and Chris Jones. Say hi, Chris.
How you doing, everybody?
On the download, we're in for Justin Kaufman. And we were just talking about Lady Bird. And we're going to talk about apologies in a little bit, too. Was there anything else? There was something else. Oh, I know what we were going to say. We were just talking off during the break about Get Out and how the Golden Globes, which, by the way, are completely useless, except for the fact that people take them seriously, which then makes them serious. But they're not serious. It's junketeers. And they come, you know, they have all these extra films that are nominated because they want to, you know, nominate more films. So they call it, is it a comedy or a musical or is it a drama? So Get Out is going to be entered as a comedy for the Golden Globes for Best Pictures. And Get Out has its funny moments, but it's a pretty serious
film. Well, these genres, they are, the divisions they are melting, Mark Caro.
Yeah. So,
speaking of people who are melting.
Yes. Beside Penelope March, who we're going to hear about later.
News today.
Yes.
Minnesota Democratic Senator Al Franken, a female radio news anchor, said today that he had groped and forcibly kissed her without her consent during an overseas USO tour in 2006, which I think Franken was elected to the Senate in 2008.
Yes.
So that was like 2 years before that.
Right.
And there is a photograph that's been online today of Franken in an embarrassing position, in a photograph that nobody wants to be photographed in or doing. And he's apologized, and like a lot of the way these things have gone is he's done an apology, then he kind of redid his apology. It's like
he elaborated on his apology.
Or what is the other word? There's like the restated,
rebooted,
elaborated, you know, made again, that sort of thing. The pattern there in these apologies from these guys seems to be that it's very difficult to accept initially that they need to apologize. So the first apology tends to be defensive and tends to be, you know, often critical of what, you know, of the person who is coming forward at some cost to themselves. And it's only when this apology, Louis C.K. had the same issue. It's only when this apology doesn't go over well, Kevin Spacey, same issue. It doesn't matter what form you use, whether it's Twitter, whether it's a Facebook statement or a statement through a publicist, people seem to find it very difficult to apologize properly. And also, people are now dissecting. I mean, like, the other side of this is that every word of every apology is being dissected for even a hint of defensiveness. And so eventually people figure this out and then they apologize properly. And that seems to be, you know, the trajectory, what happened today with Al Franken. And the amazing thing is it happened seemingly in a matter of minutes. You went from an accusation,
right,
apology, restated apology, and it was this entire cycle. This is how the world rolls now, an entire cycle in a matter of minutes.
Well, that's the world we're living in, the whole social media thing, where it has to happen very fast. And, you know, Kevin Spacey came out, you know, it's still like the worst, you know, sort of apology in the history of,
yes,
you know,
was.
Owning
yes,
up for things. The worst mea culpa ever was, yes, Kevin Spacey, you know, using his apology to come out as a proud, you know, gay man. And it was like, no, he's like, you can't connect these things. You know, Louis C.K. was considered, you know, somewhat better, but he kept repeating. I realize now that as someone who was admired by these women, I admired,
yes,
just that, and he never actually used the words, I'm sorry or I apologize. It was like, I realize now that I shouldn't have been doing those pretty obviously rude things.
Well, the word
admired
is so inappropriate in an apology. When you're apologizing.
And predicament was in there too.
Predicament
was
not good either. But admired is a real no-no. Like, you know, I was admired. And I think what everybody, you know, what the women who were describing what had gone on, it wasn't that they admired him. It was the fact that he was powerful. And instead of saying, I recognize I had a position of power and that people couldn't do anything because I have so much power, he was sort of saying, he was implying that their admiration,
that was the power.
And not true. I mean, there are powerful people who are admired. Absolutely true. But power and being admired are not the same thing. And
right,
he failed to sort of recognize that. And I think actually, I mean, Franken sort of got there more quickly, but then I guess with every apology, people figure out how not to repeat the mistakes of the previous apology.
Well, so it raises the question of, is it possible to apologize for anything anymore? You know, can Al Franken say the right thing? Is there a right thing that he could say when he has been, you know, this is an incident, you know, again, you know, the Kevin Spacey thing or the Harvey Weinstein. There has been this onslaught of tales of very abusive behavior. This is one case of him being just a disgusting pig during a comedy tour, writing a sketch in which he was going to kiss this woman, you know, and then insisting on rehearsing it, which just seems like, you know, just kind of boys club ick, right?
Mm-hmm.
And all these people have talked about, you know, just how the comedy world is such a boys club, you know, man centric. And this, it just confirms everything about that. And the question is, can someone move on from that? You know, this is from 2006. And can an apology be part of that? Because everyone is so hyper aware of apologies and, you know, how to construct them, that when you write a good one, they're like, well, someone wrote this for you, obviously, or something like that. We are at, by the way, 312-981-7200. We would love to hear from you on this. You may text us at 312-981-7200. You may call us at 312-981-7200, but feel free to chime in. And, I'm just going to read the statement.
This is Al Franken's statement.
Yeah,
this is the most recent one.
So the first thing, I think he was being interviewed, and I was looking for that now, but I think he sort of gave a response like, oh, it was a little less committal. And I think when it was sort of dawned on him how serious this was, this is what he says. The first thing I want to do is apologize to Leanne, to everyone else who was part of that tour, to everyone who has worked for me, to everyone I represent, and to everyone who counts on me to be an ally and supporter and champion of women. There's more I want to say, but the first and most important thing, and if it's the only thing you care to hear, that's fine, is I'm sorry. I respect women, I don't respect men who don't, and the fact that my own actions have given people a good reason to doubt that makes me feel ashamed. But I want to say something else too. Over the last few months, all of us, including and especially men who respect women, have been forced to take a good hard look at our own actions and think, perhaps shamefully for the first time, about how those actions have affected women. For instance, that picture. And this is the picture that you alluded to, where he's
groping a woman.
He looks like he's grabbing, for instance, that picture. I don't know what was in my head when I took that picture, and it doesn't matter. There's no excuse. I look at it now, and I feel disgusted with myself. It isn't funny. It's completely inappropriate. It's obvious how Leanne would feel violated by that picture. And what's more, I can see how millions of other women would feel violated by it. Women who have had similar experiences in their own lives, women who fear having those experiences, women who look up to me, women who have counted on me. Coming from the world of comedy, I've told and written a lot of jokes that I once thought were funny, but later came to realize were just plain offensive. But the intentions behind my actions aren't the point at all. It's the impact these jokes had on others that matters, and I'm sorry it's taken me so long to come to terms with that. While I don't remember the rehearsal for the skit as Leanne does, I understand why we need to listen to and believe women's experiences. I'm asking that an ethics investigation be undertaken, and I will gladly cooperate. And the truth is, what people think of me in light of this is far less important than what people think of women who continue to come forward to tell their stories. They deserve to be heard and believed, and they deserve to know that I am their ally and supporter. I have let them down, and I am committed to making it up to them. Period.
Well, that's a good apology. Of course, he didn't get there straight away, which is important to think about. But he didn't get there straight away. Hey, everybody. Welcome to The Download. This is Chris Jones, the Tribune critic and columnist, here with you with my great pal, Mr. Mark Caro.
Hello.
Author, host of Is It Still Funny? At the Music Box Theatre. We should talk about that a bit later. Big time book writer. We're here for Justin. We're here through 11 o'clock. We're glad you're joining us. We're glad to be along. We've been talking about all kinds of things. We're just in the middle of talking about the big news story of the day. Al Franken, who was accused of groping a woman on an overseas USO tour in 2006, he sort of apologized, finally got to a real apology. It's been a sort of a big story today. It's upset a lot of people, like all these things do, but for some people, I think Franken was more upsetting because a lot of people thought of him as sort of not of that ilk, which has proved to be otherwise. We're joined right now by our good pal Michael Phillips, movie critic at the Chicago Tribune.
Hi, man.
Hey.
It's good to see you.
How you doing?
We're good, and we're glad you're joining us.
This is great.
Did you bring us some steak?
No, this is right. Last time we were together, we were having a fine kind of 1950s-style meal.
We should do that.
At a steakhouse downtown.
That's exactly. So what did you make of the Al Franken apology? Or the final apology?
The second one, yeah, right.
They always
tend to revise upward or sideways or something. But I think in this case, at least, it hardly matters really in the end, because what he did matters more. But The fact that he actually said the words I'm and sorry in the same sentence together.
Right.
Puts him ahead of Louis C.K., for example.
Yeah, right. Right.
Yeah.
And he didn't repeat admired about 55 times. Also.
Yeah. And it didn't. And he didn't turn it into a kind of a soul-searching thing about how he needs to change as an individual as much as just kind of just realize, owning up to what he did. So.
Yeah. And the truth is, what people think of me in light of this is far less important than what people think of women who continue to come forward to tell their stories.
Right. It's the opposite of what Louis C.K.
So. It seems like it's about as comprehensive and well worded and intentioned as it could be. And then the question is, are we as a society ready to accept this apology, or what has to happen for this apology to be accepted?
Well, I think we're not in a redemption narrative moment, right?
No.
Maybe that's coming because it's interesting. I've been thinking that, there's been all of this barrage of accusations, and then they've all ended, and there's a sense that these guys, many of them are done. Some of them may well be in jail eventually. Not all of them, but some of them. And we're not in a moment where anyone is really ready to hear anything other than you're done. And then it's not really, it's like this purge, as it were, seems to have to take place before anybody can talk about anything else. And because it's so overwhelming that I think the number of people in this situation is so overwhelming.
But I would say that I would caution using the word purge, because that really does make it sound like you have a lot of vengeful, relatively unstable people behind
it. No, I don't think so.
True.
I mean, a purge is to take something that is in a system and get rid of it. And that's sort of what
When in different situations, much different than this whole kind of like amazing sort of harassment, streak we're all living in, every few hours we have another enormous news cycle to kind of like add to the story. But it's really more just like, okay, it's zero tolerance policy. And you can say, well, where did that come from? Or why don't I get my second chance? Or where's the redemption narrative? But for now, it's the pendulum is swinging the other way. It's zero tolerance for a while. And who knows in 5 years where we're going to be sitting. But, the hope, I think, for a lot of people is that they'll be sitting in a place where more women are running whatever show is in the industry. They've been marginalized too long.
Right, and this all started, as well as anything could start, with those very well reported pieces on Harvey Weinstein, and his reaction also was just horrible. The whole thing was basically that part of I think the zero tolerance is that his whole initial reaction to it was kind of like, I'm going to get my treatment and then I'm going to come back and I'm going to take down the NRA in the meantime and you're going to root for me and all this stuff. And it was so cynical that it was kind of like laying out. It was like he was deconstructing the recovery, trajectory, his narrative. Like he was saying, this is bad now, so just check off the box that I'm going to go to rehab and I'm going to do all this stuff and it's going to be okay. And then just this onslaught of, accusations against him and really criminal stuff. And you're like, no, this narrative doesn't work. You can't just say, I'm just going to go on the redemption tour. And Kevin Spacey can't just say, I'm just going to go get my treatment.
I'm gay, suddenly.
Yeah, right. Now I'm willing to admit it because it's going to help me. I mean, it was just, that was bad on so many levels. And so I think everyone's sort of recognizing, because all the news cycles are so sped up, they're like, I don't want to go on the whole sort of, I'm not ready to forgive them yet, And even if they write a really nice apology like Al Franken did, but people were hoping he was going to run for president. And it's like, well, can he run for president? No, because this happened. But then again, the president, the guy who was elected president had, stuff come out,
I don't think he was ever going to run. I don't think he was ever going to run. I mean, when he came through Chicago for the Printers Row Book Fair, which seems like a hell of a long time ago, it was just a few months ago, but he was pretty adamant about it. And maybe everybody says they don't run until they run.
Well, maybe the whole running or not running is less important. Is does this guy's voice not get heard now because of what he did?
Right. Let me ask you guys this, two things. Two things have been really bugging me now that we've had, many people between Weinstein and coming off of Donald Trump's, the accusations against Donald Trump and what we know about what he said. James Toback, Kevin Spacey, all this.
Roy Moore.
Roy Moore.
Who has not apologized.
Roy Moore and now, Al Franken and who knows tomorrow, right? But two things. the one thing really depresses me, it's actually lowered the bar for human decency. Like, so many people can now just sort of say, well, I may be difficult or a bully, but I'm not as bad as those guys. Mm. It's actually lowered the bar for human decency, I think. And the other thing is that it's really... And
what do you mean? Let's unpack that a little. What do you mean, lowered the bar?
Well, I mean, I think it actually, having all this really skeezy behavior kind of spieling out every day is making... I don't know if it's making people, men, question their behavior as much as it might otherwise, because I think they basically just start to think, well, as long as I'm not as bad as all that, I'm a reasonably good human being. You know, I can be. I don't know. That sort of hits me that way. No, not you're not.
And I've been in conversations where look, we're three dudes talking about this right now, and
we've got to deal with it.
We do have to deal with it. No, I do. And that's sort of the reflexive defensiveness where I mean, it's like I feel like I've been on like the other end of it where not the other end of it, but it's just like I just can't imagine this behavior. I can't imagine doing it, and I'm not going to raise my hand going, I've never done this, because there are people who get defensive about it, like, well, this is just tarring everyone with the same brush. I'm like, nah, get over
okay,
it.
But,
you know?
But
who cares?
But I mean, are you at all nagged at the times, whatever it is, college or in your 20s, whatever, where you overheard or saw or heard were in some sort of social situation where somebody was behaving badly, patronizing at maybe bullying or humiliating or even sexually harassing somebody, and you didn't do everything you should have done at that moment? It was more of like a shrug or silence or just sort of like changing the subject, or you just didn't really call them out on it. You weren't the upstander you wish you were. And now that frankly bugs me a bit.
Because you were.
So in breaking news, the president just tweeted, the Al Frankenstein picture is really bad. The Al Frankenstein picture is really bad. That's what the president just tweeted.
Yeah, S-T-E-I-N.
S-T-E-I-N.
No is no. No is always no. If they say no, it means 1,000 times no.
Welcome back, everybody, to The Download. This is Chris Jones and Mark Caro. We're in for Justin Kaufman. We're glad you're along. It's 9:21. If you were watching, if you're in your car right now, if you were home watching cable news, you'd be seeing people talking about the very thing that we're talking about, which has been the Al Franken story today and the president's recent tweet, the Al Frankenstein picture is really bad.
Speaks 1,000 words. Exactly. This is the whole tweet. And then he says, where do his hands go in pictures 2, 3, 4, 5, and 6 while she sleeps? ...
This is all the president's tweet.
That's the president's tweet.
So we're joined also by our good pal, Michael Phillips, who's a movie critic, but also a thinker about masculinity in this moment, and a smart dude on all these topics.
Dude is the right word tonight. Dude. This is tonight, guys. WGN stands for White Guys Nonstop.
Well, not entirely.
Not entirely. God.
Because we have our fabulous producer, Cash, who is like listening in.
She's going to come in.
Tell us, break up the dude circle for a second. Yeah, come on, go right ahead and do that.
I feel like it's almost ironic and sad that it took till 2017 for, guys to actually stop and realize, like, hey, maybe this is wrong. We shouldn't do these things to women. And it's like, if women flipped the script and did what guys do to them, it'd be really odd. Like, if a guy got catcalled, it'd be really awkward. They'd be like, what? That's weird. I'm walking down the street. Or if a girl was like, oh, well, his jeans were really tight, or, his shirt seemed a little revealing, like, that kind of stuff is really awkward. So I feel like it's very important that men have to, like, put other men in their place. Like, hey, what you're doing is wrong. And then what you were saying a while ago about, like, when you were in your 20s, I feel like oftentimes guys will not call out other guys if they're their friends. They're like, yeah, oh, well, he's my friend. He didn't mean any harm by it. But if it's a random guy that he sees, he may call him out on it. And I feel like for men to even do anything, like, moving forward, they first need to look at what they've done in their past and be like, you know what, I did do this. I did something similar to this that was wrong. How can I influence and teach other men, younger men, not to do things as this moving forward?
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right. And I think the part of the awkwardness in the conversation for some people, too, is that, I mean, I'll just say this because it sounds self-serving, but it's true. you know, the things that I'm reading about are things that I never would imagine doing to another human being, period, whether it's a woman or a man. But obviously, because, you know, there's a sexual harassment, assault aspect of this, it just never would occur to me, because it just wouldn't occur to me. You know, there are nice guys out there. And so then you also go on Facebook or something, and you see this defensiveness, like, well, I'm not doing this, da 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 da. And it kind of doesn't matter whether, you know, it sort of doesn't matter whether I, you know, was nice to women or not. I mean, it does matter, but like these obviously, just the fact that there's so many women who are going through this, yes, everyone needs to be on high alert. And it doesn't matter what your identity is in all of this, if you're a guy or a woman or anything else, everyone just has to be of the, you know, the stance of this is not acceptable, and you all have to speak out on it.
Well, I think the worst thing about these really like 10 out of 10 high-end horrible examples of what we're how Harvey Weinstein, James Toback, and Kevin Spacey and all these people, you know, it almost lets the vast majority of kind of more like, you know, mid-level harassment guys, you know, off the hook, because it's like, okay, I'm not that bad. And
you know,
a lot of us, there's millions of us, I think, millions of guys out there who can look back at their, you know, at their younger selves and think, you know, can remember the people, they friends of theirs, maybe people they didn't know, but they didn't call out the behavior or the insults or even the harassment when they should have. It was more about silence or shrugging it off or changing the subject, or, you know, they just didn't do or say what they should have done.
So are you hopeful for men, Cash? Or do you, where are you? are you hopeful?
Hopeful
for the likes of us at these microphones?
For you three, yeah. Like, you three seem nice. Like you have a really good grip on it, but there's plenty of other men that don't get it, and there's still a very, very big issue with victim blaming, and that's where, instead of putting the blame on the accuser and the person that did it, instead the blame is flipped back onto the victim, and I feel like that is so wrong. I feel like there's just so many cases of this that happens on, like, college campuses and, you know, in high school and whatever. I mean, just earlier today, a story broke out about a sexual assault case at Lindblom High School. And it seems like victims are afraid to come out and say anything because of the backlash that they'll receive. And I feel like that is super, super wrong. It is so ignorant of men that instead of the man actually standing up and be like, yes, I did wrong, I did this, it wants to be flipped onto the victim, like, well, look at what you've done to me. Now my image is ruined. Now I have to say my apology and recreate my entire image. Like, well, if you didn't do this in the first place, you wouldn't need to. So I think that with these bigger cases now coming out, it's definitely bringing a lot more awareness to the issue, which is always a good thing. And I feel like what you guys are doing is great, because the more that men talk about it, the more that other men will listen. I don't know what it is, but guys seem not to listen to women very much. But when males call out other males, then other males are more likely to listen to that.
So, and if I could say this again without being self-serving, and if because maybe it's actually heartening, I do think there are a lot of guys out there who really are genuinely appalled by this. They would have been appalled by this in their 20s, or if they're in their 20s now, and they don't put up with this sort of behavior. They never did, and, you know, there are nice people. There are nice guys out there, and there are also people who are completely clueless.
Oh,
obviously, we need to all get on the same page, but also to not be sort of despairing when you have this avalanche of these depressing stories, to think, oh, it's just everyone. Because, like, no, there's still, you know, was it The Onion that had the headline, you know, actress, you know, confirms Tom Hanks still nice guy or something like that. Like, there are a few of those out there. Stop
wasting time. Welcome back, everybody. This is Chris Jones. I'm here with Mark Caro.
Hello.
And we're in for Justin Kaufman on The Download. You're listening to WGN 720 WGN Radio. It is 9:38 in the evening. So we've got a packed show. We've got like an hour and 22 minutes to go. We've got in the 10 o'clock hour a visit from the great writer, one of my favorite writers, actually, Mark, Jeff Ruby from Chicago Magazine, or Jeffrey Michael Ruby, to give him his posh name. So he's also written some young adult fiction. So he's got a young or kids fiction, I suppose, right?
Yeah, he's coming from his event at Women and Children First to do his own event.
His actual book signing. So he's going to come right from the book signing right into the Showcase studio right here on Michigan Avenue. And then a little bit later, we're going to rant a little about this Facebook habit of, you don't just wish people a happy birthday, you have to donate to
right.
their favorite charity.
Exactly.
We're going to talk about that. And, you know, it's Thanksgiving next week, so we're going to try and hit you with a few recommendations for what you can do when all those boring relatives come into town. You get sick of them. Trying to think of some good shows to go see, some good stuff to do around the city.
Always
in
a good
last
idea.
Half hour, 'cause see, Thanksgiving is coming up. And we're joined currently by our really great pal, Mr. Michael Phillips, bon vivant, movie critic, smart guy,
deep thinker,
progressive thinker.
I think you're a
passionate soul.
You know, I think it's a rave review. You know, like I can't live up to that. It's just like you guys talking about Lady Bird. You know, that movie can't live up to your praise.
And we were talking before about how you're afraid to look at the news. Well, since the news, you know, on WGN started, Hollywood Reporter has a transparent star alleges Jeffrey Tambor sexually harassed her, quote, got physical. So it's now a second accusation against Jeffrey Tambor, who's on one of the most progressive shows there is on any form of television.
Well, that is where we're at this moment.
So there you go.
Okay, so set us up. We've got Mr. Phillips here who's seen a movie.
Right.
So we can say with pretty much, you know, rocks are, unless you're in the business in some way,
right.
that you haven't seen.
You
and not
seen
only
it.
Have you not seen it.
And you meaning you all of you people listening out
you
there.
Will not see.
Yeah. Not for a long time.
So set this
and
up.
And maybe you don't want to see it, but still.
Yeah, set this up.
Yeah, so Louis C.K. had a movie that he made that people didn't realize that he'd made, right? I think that it debuted at the Toronto Film Festival, but it was kind of a movie that he'd done kind of under the radar. It's a black and white film. It's called I Love You Daddy. And it's considered to have kind of echoes of Manhattan, and that he plays the father of, of a girl, 17-year-old teenager who ends up having this relationship with John Malkovich, who's this older film director.
Not really John Malkovich, playing
a director. And, at the time the movie came, the movie showed at the festival, it got some pretty, respectful reviews. And now, some critics like Manola Dargis at the New York Times has gone back and kind of re-reviewed it, having seen it in Toronto and then seen it here. And then there's our own Michael Phillips, who had not seen it in Toronto and has seen it now. And so he saw it through the filter of what's going on now. So if this movie had been released and reviewed by Michael Phillips, we read what he would have said, because that's what he did say. And maybe it's how other people would relate to this movie as well. So, Michael, tell us, is there any way to even say how you would have reacted to this movie if these accusations about Louis C.K. and his mistreatment, which again is a lame word, of women hadn't come out and become public?
You don't know, everything you see sort of at the moment you see it. Like, I don't know how I would have reacted to this film if I had seen it at the Toronto Festival. Who knows? A lot of those critics who really raved about this Louis C.K. film up there, maybe they were coming off 5, 6, 7 disappointments in a row, and then you see a comedy, even sort of this wormy, confessional, semi-autobiographical comedy, and it had something for a lot of people. I think what Manola was dealing with in her review, Manola Dargis of the New York Times, was, like a lot of other critics, was just how close to the bone Louis C.K. and his co-writer were kind of taking this thinly disguised self-portrait of himself about a guy who's really kind of, kind of a confused sexual character. And, I mean, there's scenes, of course, the most notorious stuff in I Love You Daddy is you have, now that we know what Louis C.K. was doing in terms of masturbating in front of women or on the phone after, quote, allegedly asking their permission,
Right.
And then writing this weaselly non-apology about, well, I guess I put him in a predicament,
Right.
It's just the dumbest thing he could. Anyway, in the movie, you got Charlie Day playing his comedian pal, who's has this extended, protracted scene at early in the film where he's miming masturbation, and it just goes on sort of endlessly, and it's impossible to watch that kind of thing now, and not have what actually happened in your head. But aside from that, I think this movie is just kind of messed up and unsatisfying in every other way. Now, would I have thought that 2 months ago? I will never.
Well,
know.
I was going to ask you: is it your job as a film critic to separate the biography or the events of the news from what is at least allegedly a fictional film? Can you do that? Should you do that?
You can, and I don't know if you should. It's just like saying, during the Iraq war, we saw so many movies in the, 8, 10 years ago, that we're dealing in some way with the, you know, America's invasion of Iraq or the war in Iraq, however you want to phrase it. And most of the movies were not very good. Some were good. Very few of them made money. And then you had The Hurt Locker, which was sort of an exception. Not a huge box office success, but a big critical one and won the Oscar for Best Picture. Is it possible to write about those films or think about those films without the war itself or, you know, dealing with the subject it's taking on? No, it's not possible. Now, do you turn reviews or your response to that film into just simply an excuse to, you know, kind of, you know, yak off about the war, about what you think of the war? No, that's a misuse of your critical, space and your platform. But, you know what I mean? You just can't ignore the context in which these things come
out. And you can't also, the whole art and artist thing, when the guy wrote the movie and directed the movie, it's like an expression of him in a way that Mel Gibson in Daddy's Home 2 is not. And you know what? I wasn't going to see Daddy's Home 2 anyway, but I can't watch Mel Gibson in something. And so I'm kind of inconsistent because there are people who, excuse me, have done bad things, whose music I listen to, or who I see on film, and some people who I'm just like, I just can't, you know. Mel Gibson's comic persona, I just don't find him funny in any way. And the fact that Louis C.K. did all this stuff and then is writing about it makes it more kind of quote-unquote interesting, but it also, you can't separate it because this is his expression of how he feels. I think Mark Harris tweeted about it, like watching it now, that he said it felt like, I don't have the tweet in front of me, but it was something to the effect of that watching it now, it feels like a guy who knows what's coming.
Yeah, exactly. You're talking about Louis C.K.
Yeah, Louis C.K. that somehow he knew this was all going
to
come down.
Or even kind of has almost a wish to get it out there.
Exactly.
Did you feel that when
absolutely,
you saw
it? Absolutely, absolutely. And that does give this film kind of a sick fascination. And I think people were picking up on that streak of it in Toronto, because I think, you know, a lot of the film comes very close to just sort of saying out loud, you know, I know what I've been accused of, you know, and I know the stories, and I'm going to kind of mess with you a little bit and sort of like get right up, tiptoe up right up to the worst of it, and then sort of like back off and give you a more conventional father-daughter thing. And to me, most of it just as a piece of commercial art, you know, it's hardly worth talking about. It just feels like a second-rate comedy from the 60s, like Prudence and the Pill or
something. So does he feel like he's owning it or not?
Owning it? Nah, a little bit. The most telling moment in I Love You, Daddy is the film that was supposed to open this Friday, but then got pulled by the distributor after the Louis C.K., you know, revelations, right? There's a moment where he kind of, you know, is called out by his ex-girlfriend, and he just sort of turns to her and says, look, I just want to say to all women out there, I'm sorry. I'm very bleeping sorry. And the way he says it, he is not contrite. And that, to me, that is a fascinating mixed moment. He's apologizing in a non-apologetic way.
Hello, everybody. You're listening to Chicago's very own 720 WGN, WGNradio.com. This is Chris Jones. I'm here with my good pal and co-host, Mr. Mark Caro.
Hello.
We're in for Justin Kaufman. You are listening to The Download on this lovely Thursday, the last full work week before Thanksgiving. Coming up at the 10 o'clock hour, we're going to have Jeff Ruby, Chicago Magazine dining critic, superb writer about food, also an author of fiction. He's coming right from his book signing right here to the Showcase Studio.
He's on his way.
We're also going to have suggestions about what to do, you know, holiday weekend, all those relatives coming into town. We're going to do that, and we're going to complain about Facebook, because that's always a good way to
do it. And if you want to join us in any of these complaints and conversation, 312-981-7200. Call or text. They both work. 312-981-7200.
So right now we're with our good pal Michael Phillips, movie critic, extravagant character from the Chicago Tribune. He's here with us. We're talking about Louis C.K. and this movie that he's seen. So explain, so from a business point of view, so is it possible to disappear a movie? I mean,
it's a small company that bought it. They spent a bunch of money for it in Toronto, and now it's like, whoop.
Yeah.
So what do you think?
The Orchard paid $5 million for it, which is a medium expensive
buy.
And
that all went into Louis C.K.'s pocket, or that? Yeah. Right.
And I think it's whether or not they truly believed in it. And I think they probably did, because it got, you know, a lot of people like that film, and it's still going to get a release in France, I think, and they're just sort of waiting for the right time. So that's a delayed release in some other markets, at least France. In terms of the U.S. release, maybe eventually it will come out. And I think, you know, it'll come out pirate, you know, there'll be pirated copies all over the place because there's DVD screeners that arrived
right.
10 minutes after the accusations appeared.
Right. This is why you've seen it, because you're a critic and you vote on Critics Awards. And so right. you get sent screeners and
right.
it's like this all hits the fan and then it's like, whoa, look yeah. what I got.
They didn't call you and say, you don't watch it.
No, although my editor Carmel Carrillo was watching it on a link that was provided to her by the studio, and 30 yeah. minutes in, it just simply canceled.
So somebody in
right
in the company,
yeah, just like nah. Well, they can, yeah, we,
they can stop midstream.
Due to recent tragic events, we're not going to let you. But you know, yeah, it is an unusual case, Chris, and it's this idea of kind of disappearing a movie, like it's crazy, but. You know, this is happening all over the place, right? Kevin Spacey's disappeared out of a movie he already shot, and suddenly
that's incredible.
Christopher Plummer right. steps in, and you know
that is crazy. Like a month before the movie's coming out, and they're taking every scene that he shot and replacing him. You know, they have to get the actors together, they have to get the sets together, they have to get the locations, so they could put another actor in those same scenes. It's
and
crazy.
And of course, behind the scenes, you know, there's all sorts of lucrative financial yeah. deals and arrangements
right.
that are being disappeared all over. And, you know, this is yes, it's a real lurch for the industry if you add it all up and talk about all the careers that are being thrown up. Now, do I have a problem with that personally, just as a human being on planet Earth? Not really. I mean, I think there'll be cases where, you know, that where there, maybe there is an overreaction in certain cases, or in not every instance of these, you know, the harassment or assault is as bad as sort of the worst of the stuff we've been
yeah,
reading about. But
right.
but I just think it's mitigated by the fact that finally now all these women. So many people have been writing in various, you know, for the New York Times, New Yorker, and just writing, just getting it out somehow after containing these secrets and all the shame and humiliation about what happened to them for all these years. They're finally able to be listened to.
So I have a question for both of you. Is there any artist whose work you cannot appreciate because of stuff that they've done? You know, whether it's like Polanski film or some other performer on stage or someone's music or something. Is there someone who's so tainted for you that it's something that you have liked that you're like, I can't experience this now?
Michael?
It's a good question. I think I mean, people point to Polanski. I mean, if Woody Allen were a more vital comic or any kind of filmmaker to me today, I would have more of a struggle about, well, can I put my personal ethical or moral stance on what I think may have happened with Woody Allen? To me, he hasn't made a good movie in forever. So,
yeah, but let me just take devil's advocate there and say, yeah, but as a critic, you're dealing with the backlist of a movie maker all the time, right? You're dealing with re-releases
right.
and or restorations. So that you can't really dodge yeah. the question that way, right? You've got to come out and say, okay, Woody Allen, you can't, yes, it's a little easier that he's not making new vital movies, but you still have to wrestle with him as a critic, as a giant of the industry.
The Polanski stuff, when you really read the Roman Polanski stuff, it is just horrific.
Yes,
you know, it
is
really terrible.
Yes, it is.
But you could also think, wow, Chinatown is a really cool movie.
But
that's the thing. I rarely hear people, when people talk about Chinatown, it's like sort of exists in this other, I mean, part of the Woody Allen problem is that he's so, even either he's front and center in those movies with that persona, or his persona is just, you know, being, you know, someone else is doing
yeah,
the Woody thing.
Sort of thing.
But,
yeah.
but Chinatown is just a really well written, you know, noir. Robert Towne gets a lot of credit. You got Jack Nicholson and Faye Dunaway. I mean, it's just, they're classic scenes in that movie and this classic tale of corruption in LA. And so there's sort of this sense of, well, this guy directed the movie and he made the movie. But, you know, it's somehow, like the piano, I mean, the pianist, I mean, almost won Best Picture and won a lot of Oscars. And that was like, people knew all the stuff about Polanski when this happened too. So why is he, I mean, I feel like I would like to see Chinatown again at some point, and I would be able to separate that maybe. But if I really think about Polanski, it's like, ugh, you know?
What do you say about that? Like, you know, we're running out of time, so give us your big thoughts on this.
I mean, I don't know. This news cycle, guys, it's made all the stuff we've been sort of hearing and living with the last few days, it's made the old axiom about never trust the artist trust the tale that made it's made that
never what never trust it, it.
Never trust. Well, this is the old axiom I don't even buy anymore. Okay. Never trust the artist, trust the tale. So in other words,
what
separate
does that mean?
Means you can separate whatever happened in real life from whatever the artist actually creates.
Yeah.
Right. I just think right now, I think it's inevitable that we look at everything through a new lens, at least for a while. You cannot watch Woody Allen's Manhattan the same way you did before.
And that's been true for a while.
Yeah, been true for a while. And that film always struck me as a little icky and a little something off. And now it's even what the things I liked about it are definitely sort of on the defensive. You know, I don't know. It's a good time to sort of examine what truly does, you know, draw the line for you though. What about you, Chris Jones?
I don't disagree with that. I think, you know, it's hard to discuss at this moment.
Because it's almost 10 o'clock, you mean?
It is. I know, I don't mean to punt the question. I mean, I think it has to be wrestled with. It's probably not something to be wrestled with at this second. This second is sort of about...
So there's no one in your mind who pops out like, you know, I just can't appreciate this person's work for whatever reason.
Well, I think I would argue that I view them differently. I'm not sure that I would come out and say, you know, I don't shop at Walmart because I don't think Walmart was great for American cities, say. I mean, that's sort of a little thing I do.
Mm-hmm.
Just I don't have many boycotts, but I just prefer to not do that. I find that harder with artists in general because I just find that more difficult. But I think, you know, it's just not the moment to say, I suppose, which is kind of what you're saying, Michael, right?
Well, and I think also if you're, you know, a full-time critic on a certain beat, you're being paid to kind of, you know, wrestle with your prejudices and all your personal obsessions or morality issues or anything and sort of still do the job and write about all kinds of things, some of which, you know, get into this sort of area of a gray area about, you know, what's going on in real life behind the work you're reviewing, you know.
Well, you do a great job, my friend, in these circumstances. Thank you for joining us.
Thanks for coming.
Welcome back, everybody. This is the final hour of The Download on this Thursday night. This is Chris Jones. I'm here with my great pal, co-host...
Mark Caro. That's
Caro,
me.
That's him. You know,
pause so I could say it.
You can find us all over the WGN dial, but occasionally we land here in Justin Kaufman's exceedingly prestigious spot. We're glad to be here.
In the cushy chair.
I appreciate that. We're in our final hour tonight. We've got another guest, a really cool guest, I might add.
We're saying hello, Ruby Thursday.
We have the great Jeff Ruby, who is the dining critic for one of the dining critics, right, for the Chicago Magazine, and also a writer. We're going to talk about your book a little bit later, but what's
Jeffrey Michael Ruby?
Yeah,
right?
You've got two names.
My fancy author name.
So you have a different name as a critic?
Well, I'll tell you why. There's a Jeff Ruby who owns a steakhouse, a bunch of restaurants in Cincinnati, who has ruined the name for me. So if you Google Jeff Ruby book, his biography comes up.
Oh.
My Life in Steak.
Yeah, pretty much. So I had to go with Jeffrey Michael Ruby for the fiction. That was it.
Well, before we get into the
sounds
book,
like a serial, you know, killer.
Tell us about the how's the dining scene? What's hot? Hottest thing. Come on.
I'll tell you what's a really great restaurant right now is Marisol. Jason Hamill, the chef owner of Lula Cafe, has opened in the MCA, and it is.
Yeah, I've actually been in there. It's really good.
It's really good. And it's better than it needs to be, you know, for, you know, you think of museum food as being, whatever. But no, it's I think, every bit as good as Lula.
And kind of gorgeous. I mean, it's got those murals.
Beautiful.
On the wall.
Beautiful.
It's like a stunning place. I was like knocked out by it. It's like revolutionized the basement of that museum.
Absolutely. And I think people are thrilled with it.
I've not been there. I'll have to try
it. You've got to try it. You know, because it's like it's in the basement of the MCA, which is a kind of a pit of a place.
Right.
I go there a lot because there's a performance space there. And it's opened. It's like exploded with this new restaurant.
Right. And it used to be the Wolfgang Puck Boring Cafe or whatever
right.
it was called.
That is what it was called, actually.
The Boring Cafe.
The Wolfgang Puck's Boring Cafe. Jeff Ruby
is up to its name.
He's a spider in our midst.
Yeah. Did you know that? When Mark Caro has this article in Chicago Magazine saying, you know, it's all about the big data in restaurants.
Oh, right. Of course.
And if it's a food writer like a Jeff Ruby.
I'm a spider.
If you're a Grace, yes. At least you're a spider. I'm sure you're something else somewhere else.
Are you a VI?
I want to know what sort of vermin I am in other, other restaurants.
Do you make reservations under your own name? You do not.
No, I have a fake name that I'm sure they're all onto by now. Or in my wife's name.
It's Jeffrey Steven Ruby.
It's so hard to trick these people.
And you have a ton of credit cards. What about when you pay the bill? Do you have a credit card not in your name?
Well, I use my wife's. I used to have one with a fake name on it. I was Evan Waterford for years, but I kept forgetting the name. I kept saying I was Waterman.
So right now, Mark, in the data, in the little thing, it says Jeff Ruby, wife's name, uses credit card in wife's name.
Yeah, they're listening. They're taking
listening
notes.
Right now.
They're all everyone's glued to it because this is this is appointment listening right now. So yeah, you're cooked. And they're also, the other thing is that there are people in the showcase studio who are taking your picture right now.
Yeah, they're
like,
they're
my
taking
God.
Notes there. The whole
yeah,
thing.
You're in
it's
bad.
All over.
That's why you had to go into the young adult fiction world to just
right. The 10-year-olds are the only ones who don't know me now. So
well, we're gonna talk more about your new book in just a minute. So don't go away, because Jeff is not just a dining critic, but he's also an auspicious author. Came directly, Mark Caro.
From Women and Children First.
From Women and Children First.
You know, I was going to go to his... I had it on my calendar, and then we got asked to do this shift, and I was going to go to his book launch, the big book launch. I read, Jeff is actually in a writer's group with me, and I read an early draft of this, and it was fantastic and really fun, and I was really going to be there for it, and I thought, well, if I can't be there, we're going to have to bring him here.
All right, so we'll hear about that in a minute. Okay. Welcome back, everybody, to The Download. This is Chris Jones in with Mark Caro. We're here for Justin Kaufman. It's our last hour. We're talking with Jeff Ruby, the dining critic for Chicago Magazine. You've probably read a lot of his reviews. But he's also the author of this new book, Penelope March is Melting. And after all the sleazy stuff we've been talking about, it's sort of comforting to talk about a book that is aimed at 9 to 12-year-olds.
I mean, brought in by Tiny Tim singing The Ice Caps Are Melting. Oh, ho, ho, ho. Because how often do you get to hear that? It's one of the great, ridiculous songs of all time.
Your one chance to use that as a segue for it to make sense.
So that song starts, by the way, it goes... One eye is brown. The other is brown. All right, now we can talk.
All right, so your book, the heroine of your book is a sixth grader called Penelope March, right, who has to sort of keep Glacier Cove afloat.
Correct.
So why? So is it melting? What's going on with Glacier Cove?
Exactly? She lives on a town.
A
magical town.
On? Not in, but on? Like,
What would you say? I mean, it's an iceberg floating somewhere near Antarctica that nobody knows about. And it's this magical town that has people and churches and hockey teams and dogs and, like all this stuff. And suddenly it starts to melt, but nobody notices except for Penelope, and she's the only one who can save
it. Is she just smarter than everybody else, or what?
Well, she's surrounded by people who are not curious about the world, and they just accept everything about it. And
there could be some modern-day parallels of people not noticing that the world is melting. Right. But
I try not to hit people over the head with the environmental message, but it's definitely sort of underlying everything.
So what made you do a book for young people like this?
I realized at some point as I was writing this, there's a thing on Microsoft Word where you can find out what grade level you're writing at. And I realized I thought I was writing for adults. It said I was writing at a fourth grade level. So I bumped it up a few, fancy words, and suddenly I'm writing at a fifth grade level, and it was perfect.
Have you done your Chicago Magazine pieces on that? What grade level are you?
I think I'm more like eighth grade.
Oh, good.
I'm at least in like middle school.
I've never done that. I should do that.
It's kind of horrifying.
It's humbling. Wow. It's humbling.
It's very humbling.
And then you do it before and after you get edited.
Yes. My editors are much smarter than I am.
Well, they always say you don't want to write down to this age group, right? That's the worst thing you can possibly do, isn't it?
No, I actually – so I have three kids, and one of them is 10 and one of them is 12, and the 10 and 12-year-olds helped edit this book before I ever got it to an agent or to an editor. They would go through paragraphs and say – I don't know what this means, so I just skip this paragraph. And I go, okay, that's good to know. That is good to know. It was like my own little focus group in my mouth. And they were ruthless to me, absolutely ruthless. So that helped greatly.
So what was the genesis of the story? Like, what? Where did this? Did you, like, we just laying there or hanging out, and suddenly you're like a girl in an iceberg on a town?
It's a no. This is a classic Chicago thing. Hottest day of summer about 4 years ago. We don't have air conditioning. My wife doesn't believe in ceiling fans. It's just like, it's incredibly hot in the apartment. So I did that thing where you walk to the kitchen and put your head in the freezer.
Yeah, really? You really did that?
I really did that. And I'm bleeding.
Does she believe in that?
She didn't like that very much. I'm breathing in these icy clouds, and I open my eyes, and I'm face to face with like a whole bunch of ice cubes. And up close, ice cubes are like little planets with valleys and mountain ranges, and just like in my mind, suddenly something just popped in there. Like, what if it was just the whole world in there, and you know, there was some adventure? And that was kind of the start of it. And then it took a lot of work and making it, turning it into something, because I have lots of ideas that end up being just garbage ideas. And this one could have easily been garbage, but I kind of
is this your first such thing?
It's my first novel, yeah. Yeah.
So are you, as a journalist, did you always think, you know what, at some point, you know, I'm doing this journalism stuff, but I really want to do creative writing.
Don't we all?
Don't we all?
I do.
Don't we all, Mike Caron?
Yeah. I do, absolutely. Yeah.
Well, I mean, it's not like there's like a racket in journalism or in fiction writing.
No,
so
no.
I think it was something that I always wanted to try. And I think writing for kids, this is for 11, 12-year-olds before people start to get jaded about the world. And
yeah, so that's a kind of a great age, isn't
it's
it?
It's a great
it's that
age.
Moment right before, yeah.
My 12-year-old is starting to get a little jaded. She might be a little, now she might not be caught dead reading this, but, you know, I think that there's something about that age that is just fascinating to watch, and to see these kids get into it feels really good.
Do you have other novels that you'd started or written or any of that? Or was this the first one you just sort of sat down and said, okay, I'm just going to do this?
I've tried many novels over the years and have failed miserably and have gotten far on some and not very far on others. But this is the first one that I actually followed through on and finished. And the only way I did it is because I'm scared of my wife. And she basically said to me, you go off to a cabin for a month and finish this novel and don't come back until you've got it done.
This is the same woman who doesn't believe in air conditioning.
Yes.
No, but she believes in letting you go as a writer. I mean, that's
yes.
a gift to
it's
say
an unbelievable
you
gift.
Could go do this on your own and I'm just going to take care of the home front.
Is that what you did then?
That's
amazing.
That's what I did. I went to this little cabin in Arkansas.
Not in Iceland, so you could see them.
Quite the opposite. I mean, it was the middle of summer in Arkansas and it was 105 degrees every day. And I wrote this book basically out of fear because I didn't want to come home without it and because my wife would have, God knows what, I don't know.
Yeah, no, no,
so,
I can hear that.
It worked. Writing out of fear is kind of the best, sometimes the best writing for me.
Well, so everyone writes out of fear on some
right.
level.
Yeah.
So this is for the independent-minded young person, right? This book, it's for the person who doesn't follow the crowd.
I think so. I mean, I hope so. It's a book that sort of emphasizes being curious about the world. And not taking things at face value and about the dangers of conformity and, you know, there's lots of girl power stuff
right.
there too. And
no, it's a good girl heroine. I mean, they got the girl's name in the title. And
right.
I don't...
Yeah.
It was important to me for it to be a female protagonist, even though I don't know anything about what it's like to be a 12-year-old girl, but there's enough stories with boys saving the day that it seemed like the right thing to do.
You sold the film rights yet?
I was going to make a Harvey Weinstein joke there, but I decided not.
There are no Harvey Weinstein jokes.
I can't go there.
No.
Does this become a series, though?
I guess it depends on whether this sells. If it sells well, I'm happy. You know, I've got ideas for directions to take it, but nobody's going to buy a sequel for a book that didn't sell, so we'll see what happens.
So
you've got I'm sorry to just cut in, but I was gonna say you have an event this weekend that people, if they want to come get this book from you and have you hear you talk about it and see you and have you sign it, where can they go?
Yes, 57th Street Books in Hyde Park on Sunday at 3:00. I will be there. I will be signing. There will be homemade cookies made by my kids.
Is your wife going to be there? And we could.
She will be there.
She's a lovely woman, by the way.
She'll be there.
She's great. I know this.
She's not coming off so well in this particular segment.
She is the most wonderful human being.
Yeah, keep going. You got a bit of catch.
No, come on. If your wife said, here, go off for a month and write, so I'll take care of everything, you would be like, oh, my God.
It's the head in the freezer moment that sticks.
Well, he put it in the freezer himself.
It's true. She didn't stick my head in
the ceiling fan wouldn't help.
All right, next. And before you leave, like, what's your next review? Where are you going? Where are you going to go next?
I can't tell people where I'm going to be. No. I mean, I can tell you.
And what name will you use?
Where have you just been?
Well, I just went to City Mouse, which is in the Ace Hotel. Jason Vincent, the guy from Giant, and Ben Lustbader, and their chef is Patrick Sheeran, who's been at a zillion restaurants, super talented guy. Really interesting place, and it's across from the Google building. So there's all these tech bros hanging out there, but it's like it's sort of a weird and off-kilter place.
It's become a real restaurant nexus over there. I mean, you got Next and the Aviary and Royster and Smith and Sons and
Swift and Sons.
Yeah. I knew that was coming out wrong.
Yeah, and then this, and then right across the street is Regards to Edith, which is the guy from Deus Ex and Longman and Eagle. That's his place. So, there's a lot happening over there.
Well, and if you have a young person at home and you want to buy Jeff's book, it's called Penelope March is Melting, and it's available at that great online giant, I'm sure. Or you can go to, where can you see this weekend?
We can see him at 57th Street Books on Sunday at 3. Right. He also probably just left behind a bunch of signed copies at Women and Children First because he just had an event. So how did that event go?
It was great.
Anybody show up?
Packed the house. My entire family. No, it was a lot. Yeah, we had a good crowd.
All your wife's friends.
Yes.
and our writers, I would get.
It was terrific. Right.
Jeff, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, guys.
It's great. Good luck with the book. Welcome back to The Download. This is Chris Jones. I'm here with my friend and co-host, Mark Caro.
Hello.
We're here all the way till 11 o'clock. It's our last segment. We've been here since 7. We've been talking about all kinds of good stuff, and we're going to entertain you, we hope, for the next 22 minutes.
And the turkey that we served for a Thanksgiving feast at 7 is now cold turkey, right?
But not,
oh, that's next week.
But not the turkey you'll be serving next week. So you've been wanting, you've been sort of saying all night, no, we've got to talk about this Facebook donation. You've been going on about it. This Facebook donation thing. So it's...
No, it's, you know what, you? This is one of those, this is like a completely ungracious thing to complain about. So I will. We'll give you some Thanksgiving tips, too. And I'll put a plug in for the next Is It Still Funny movie at the Music Box, which I'm hosting next Wednesday night, which is Galaxy Quest. But, yeah, Facebook. You know, I'm like one of these people. Chris Jones, I don't know about you, but I'm sort of a compulsive Facebook birthday greeter. Like people have their, I go on the home page on Facebook and I see whose birthdays there are and I try to say happy birthday and I try to, if I know them, which I usually do, I'll say something and I'll try to sort of tailor it to what their life is like or what they're like or what the personality is like. And maybe if it's a musician, I'll say have a rockin' birthday. Anyway, lately I'm going on and they're saying, oh, so-and-so's donated their birthday to this worthy charity. And like, that's really great. But then there's this sort of feeling like when I just say, hey, happy birthday, I feel kind of guilty. Like, oh wait, I'm not like actually giving this person money for their Facebook donation project. And then there's like a little sort of bar that says how close to the goal they're getting. And it's just kind of weird because it's like, I wasn't going to get you a present. Why am I going to spend money on you? But saying that makes you sound like a jerk.
So these people are choosing, right? Or they're choosing to say, for my birthday, I want people to donate money.
Yes. Which is a perfectly noble, fine thing to do. The problem is that like a lot of people are doing it and then it just, then you become like, oh, it's like walking past someone on the street and you're like, I really like this person, but I'm not giving, I'll donate to my own charity that I'm going to pick or something like that. But then it just makes you sound like a jerk. Anyway, if you want to chime in on this, people in radio land, I know you're sitting there and you're like, I want to have a conversation right now. 312-981-7200. You can text us too. You don't even have to come on the phone with us. Text us, same number, 312-981-7200.
So how many people in your feed are doing, like, is this like overwhelming?
It just seems like every day or every other day. Like today there were none, but like yesterday I think maybe there was. And again, it's probably because I have too many Facebook friends and stuff. But again, it's a lovely thing to do. So if you're doing this, don't, you know, again, I'd sound like a jerk by complaining about it. But it's almost like this kind of Curb Your Enthusiasm sort of thing where it's like another thing to feel guilty about. Like, what? I'm not going to give, you know, I'm glad you're raising money for this good cause, but it's just because it's your birthday. I wasn't getting you anything.
Yeah, I guess.
You have a serious look on your face. This is a fun topic.
You don't like to donate?
I like to donate.
You like to do it in your own thing. You don't like to be...
Well, no, there have been a lot of things to donate lately, too, you know, which is good.
So this is a bit like being asked to...
I mean, it's not good that there are so many... Like, it's not good that you have... You know, that there are things going on in, like, Puerto Rico where you feel you want
to... It's a bit like you being asked at the store, would you like to add a dollar
it is like
X,
that.
Y, Z.
It is, yeah. It's like, yeah, do you want to add... And then I say no, and then I feel kind of like a bad person. So now it's like... Wishing people happy birthday on Facebook instead of making me feel like, oh, I'm just going through and adding to the 100, you know, 200, whatever, you know, greetings they're having. Like, oh, I'm skipping the part where I'm supposed to, like, give money and help them to their goal. I don't know.
But, I mean, the people in fundraising would say that unless you obligate people, they don't give as much money. You know, like, in other words, because you it's in your face, you feel bad about that's actually their number one fundraising.
But, like,
that's
if you said... You know, there's terrible stuff happening in Puerto Rico, again, to use that example. So I'm donating to this and, you know, you can donate too by giving here. Then it's like, but it's like for my birthday and it's like if I have a party and if I invited you to a party, so look, in lieu of gifts, you know, don't bring wine or anything, you know, give a present to, you know, give a donation to this. Something. That's great. But like on Facebook, when you're friends with like 2,000 and something people, which I am, and other people are, to sort of say, I'm donating my birthday, it's sort of like asking 2,000 people to, I don't know, it just seems like an imposition.
Yeah.
Like I wouldn't do it.
I mean, I guess that there's already the discomfort with the automated Facebook greeting. So I always sort of think, okay, when someone's wishing me a happy birthday, my wife just had a big birthday that I won't mention the number on the air in case she's listening, but it's like, you know, I was reading her feed of all the happy birthdays and you're like, well, would you have done that had you not been reminded? Then she was arguing that doesn't matter. People need to be reminded. There's nothing
wrong. It's hard to keep track of it. In fact, sometimes I'll forget someone's birthday which I never forget because it didn't come up on Facebook and I sort of like use that and rely on that probably too much to remind me of birthdays. And I'm like, oh wait, that person's birthday isn't on Facebook. They're just my friend whose birthday happens to be on this day.
I've noticed too that, you know, sometimes the first people to wish you a happy, like the first person to wish me a happy birthday for my last birthday was Southwest Airlines. They got in like 4 days before. They're like, we just want to wish you a happy birthday,
right.
Chris.
Yeah, that's
I was really touched by that.
You're really touched. Yeah, well, that's nice.
By the emotion. No, just the big heart of Southwest Airlines.
Oh, they're like, they're you know, like every restaurant, maybe, you know, that's another thing that the restaurants do, by the way. You know, if you go for your anniversary to a restaurant, you know, if they don't take note that it's your restaurant and you go there the next year, you know, they should know that it's your anniversary without you even mentioning it, or your birthday for that matter.
Without you having to.
People, you know, there's definitely business to be done in keeping track of people's birthdays and then wishing them happy birthday.
Although for some of us, like being recognized in a restaurant and having like six servers sing, I know I like to go. My tradition, as you well know, is to go to Benihana for my birthday, which,
right.
You know, and there's a, and of course, happy birthday for years was under copyright, so all of these restaurants
right.
couldn't
their
sing
own
happy
song.
Birthday, so they all made up.
I'm going to write a new birthday song.
Usually a military-style clappy song.
Yeah. Clappy song. So you like that. You like that spectacle well, being made for your birthday, but you're just not going to ask people to give money on Facebook.
I wouldn't do that. No, I would find that, it's impositional, you know, and I don't know, there's so much. At this moment in our lives, there's so much of that. It's just so much of that, which is what we were talking about with
the same time. In the same time, though, I would not want any of my Facebook friends who would be listening to this to think, oh, okay, just cut him out of this. Cut him out of this, you know, like don't even let him see my birthday greeting anymore. And then, you know, I saw someone too, like they unfriended someone and then there's like a thing. We noticed that you unfriended this person. That person won't be able to see your updates, and you won't be able to see theirs. But don't worry, we won't tell them you unfriended them. And it's like this whole kind of first person, like plural thing that Facebook's saying, like, don't worry, we won't tell them.
Hey, Mark.
But we'll know, winky, winky.
Well, we'll know. Hopefully you'll know, and we'll tell you anyway. A few things you can do for Thanksgiving next week when we come right back. Welcome back, everybody. This is Chris Jones here with Mark Caro. We're in for Justin Kaufman. You are listening to 720 WGN and The Download. It's our last segment.
Hello.
It's been a great night. How great that you've been listening to us. That's very kind of you.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
Yeah. We thought we'd end our lovely show with a few ideas. Let's just talk Thanksgiving because it's coming right up. It's sort of
It's early. A week from today. It's I know. It is show. Early. I know. Yeah. I'm like, wait a minute.
I keep thinking it's a week later than it is.
I know. And you know, for me, because I'm going to smoke a turkey.
As always.
Yeah, I've done this like, it'll be like a third or fourth
in
year
the egg,
row,
right? In the
in
egg.
The big green egg.
The big green egg. Wait. What is a big green egg exactly?
Big green egg is a large ceramic, I think Japanese originally styled. It looks like a big, you know, barbecue, you know, dome, but it looks like a green golf ball. It kind of has the,
and it's like better?
The indentations, and it's really heavy. And so and it has the vent on the top and then a vent on the bottom. And what it does is it holds the temperature really consistently. So if you're making, let's say, a brisket, and I might smoke it for 15 hours. You could set it by like how much you open the vents and the stuff you put in it and then the wood you put on. You can get it at like 220 degrees and keep it at that for almost the entire time without having to put more stuff on it. So, and it's like you could do it in the dead of winter and it's so thick that it won't really, it just doesn't, you know, cause like they're aluminum ones, but you know, they're going to be more sensitive to the outside. So it's just a way of sort of smoking stuff at a consistent low temperature. You could do stuff at high temperatures too, but I just tend to do them at low. And I've done a turkey the last few years. Usually end up with a pretty big turkey. I go to the farmer's market in Evanston, and there's a farm, Gast Farms it is, and they just ask who wants a turkey, and it's just the turkeys that they've got at their little farm in Wisconsin, which I feel better about than going to get the butterball.
Right, right.
Yeah, it's turned out pretty great. And then also, when you're done with it, you take the carcass and you make a stock out of it, and you get the smoked turkey broth.
See, you get everybody all excited now.
And I have this pumpkin pie that's also really great. It's like the best
pumpkin
pie. If
you do say so, you say.
I do, and you're invited to come. All right. Bring the family.
Sounds good. So after that Thanksgiving, I just thought since you've got me for a couple of minutes, ladies and gentlemen, I just thought I'd give you just a few recommended shows.
Now, hold on. Chris, what would you recommend? I just wanted to set you up for that.
Well, if you like listening to us, and you should, I recommend the monologuist, Mike Daisy, who's actually, this is a guy who does monologues sort of based off the news. And I actually saw this show last week in Philadelphia. It's a show, it's tomorrow night, and it's called The End of Journalism, which is just really a topic dear to my heart. And it's just about the rise of Fox News and the changes in the industry. It's very, very shrewd. And then this is at Theatre Wit in Lakeview. And then on Saturday night, he's doing a show called The White Man's Burden, which he was telling me today. I talked to him today. He was telling me that it started out as a show about white supremacists and has morphed more into sort of a show about toxic masculinity. So that's a cool thing. You've got The Importance of Being Earnest up at Ryder's Theatre in Glencoe. Not bad, not perfect, but not bad. Down in Hyde Park, because we just do the whole map here on The Download, you've got Belle of Amherst, the show about Emily Dickinson, starring one of my favorite actors, Kate Fry, and that's cool. And then there's, if you like a date play, there's a show called Significant Other about this gay guy who gets left at the altar by all his female friends and he ends up being alone. That's a very, very funny, have a few drinks. And then the ultimate, as we were talking about earlier, if you're a Parrothead in town this weekend, you've got Escape to Margaritaville, which, you know, you don't have a ringing endorsement from me, but you do have, if you're a Parrothead and you've had a few of those frozen daiquiris and you like the man himself, you'll be fine.
So when you look on the calendar and you think it's time for the Goodman's Christmas Carol again, which is a wonderful show, but you must have seen it like 30 times by now.
And you jest, but I really have seen it.
I didn't jest. I was not jesting. The people in Radioland, I was not jesting. I know how old you are and how long you've been working in this business. How do you, like, go, like, what do you do? How do you find something fresh to say about it every year?
Well, I try to take the odd year off, and I did take last year off, but I think I'm going to go back this year. They have a number, you know, they're very adept at sort of finding stories. They have their first female Tiny Tim this year, which is, you know, that's interesting.
They had a female nephew last year.
That's right. They do again, and they do again. And in fact, up at there's another famous Christmas Carol up at the Guthrie Theater in Minneapolis, and they this year, I believe, have their first female Scrooge. So that's coming. That's coming.
Well, it makes sense. Why don't you?
Yeah, I mean, my complaint, frankly, with that show is I think it's time to change the script, because all of these production changes, America has changed and all of that, but that actual script is the same adaptation that people, and then they go, oh, no, it's a joyous tradition, Chris Jones. And I go, yes, but that script just needs, you know.
They could make it about me.
They could.
It would be a Christmas Carol. Didn't see that one coming,
that's
did you?
That's how you know.
Boom!
Get into the end of our show.
Oh, my goodness.
When that happens. And then, you know, we think, if you've been listening to us all night, we think that you should go see Lady Bird, which is a great movie, right?
Yeah.
What
any
else?
Other movies
Anything
you think
else?
We should come see?
What else do you want to see?
I don't know. Like any like funny movies coming up that you think we should see?
Oh, yes, that's right. Your very, very fine segment, Is It Still Funny?
Oh!
At the Historic Music Box on Southport. That's Wednesday night, right?
Wednesday night,
so everyone
yeah.
will be in a Thanksgiving mood.
Yeah, 7:15.
What's the movie?
It's Galaxy Quest.
Galaxy Quest
is a movie I actually reviewed. I think it's 98. And I actually reviewed that movie when it came out, and I thought it was all right. But it's the Star Trek spoof. It's Tim Allen and Sigourney Weaver and Alan Rickman and Sam Rockwell and they play TV actors in a Star Trek like show. But then these actual space aliens watch the show and think it's, you know, real life and documentary. So they come and take them on an actual space adventure. And it's actually very funny. And, you know, it's one of those movies that, like, my family, if it comes on, everyone's watching and they think it's hilarious. And I just sort of don't, like, look back at my old review of it because I didn't appreciate it. So anyway, I've been doing this series, as you know, Is It Still Funny, at the Music Box Theater. Once a month, we show an old comedy, see how it holds up. So Galaxy Quest is the night before Thanksgiving, so it's not. So it's like sort of a weekend. I usually do it in the middle of the week.
You don't have to wait. You don't have to work the next day.
My Wednesday is usually out of work the next day.
You can hang out at the new bar or the new-ish bar, at least, at the Music
Box. Yeah, that lounge is really nice.
Very nice.
And you bring your kids, because, you know, you could bring your kids to this one. Or you could just go get a drink and have fun.
Okay, one more for you. If you're listening to us in the suburbs, here's a suggestion for you. 42nd Street at the Drury Lane. Now, you may be thinking,
oh, yeah.
42nd Street, boring old show from the 1930s movie. But no!
That's got some buzz on it, I hear, Chris Jones.
It does. It's kind of funked up in every kind of way. It's
I've never seen it.
This is in a really radical staging where you've taken those old 30s songs, Lullaby of Broadway being probably the most famous, and they've got like a funk beat behind them now. It's like a sort of 70s sort of theme show, and the dancing, the tapping in it is really something. It's like sort of Savion Glover. There's this choreographer called Jared Grimes, who is a performer himself. It is, I think, and I will say this honestly, straight up, I've been going to Drury Lane for 20, 25 years. I think it's possibly the best show they ever did.
Wow.
And
how long is it there?
It's there all the way through January. So, you know, it's a great show. It was funny. I was writing about it in the Tribune about, you know, what a good show it was. And these readers wrote in, they were older readers, and they said, oh, we were going to go, and now you've ruined it. Is it really loud? And there are synthesizers, and there's a rock drum set, and we don't want to go anymore. So I wrote back and said, you'll be fine. It's not, you know, it's not like that. And then there's a new show at Second City, actually. You know, they don't
You like this one, I know.
I do like that one. It's called Dream Freaks Fall from Space. It's very funny. There's a very funny sketch about Putin. There's, of course, a couple of pretty decent Trump sketches. The best one is a guy, it's just a monologue saying, like, did you vote for Trump? It's a guy who's dating somebody, and he wants to know if she voted for Trump. And it's actually pretty funny. So that's a cool show.
We saw Q Brothers Christmas Carol a couple of years ago, and I see that that's back.
Yeah, and in
back.
A new space, in the splendiferous new yard at Chicago Shakespeare Theater.
All right, I haven't seen that space.
That is a pretty awesome thing. So we got that. So you got that going on. So that,
and then you could just, like, rent all the terrible movies about Thanksgiving, right? Like Home for the Holidays. holidays. I'm sorry if you're a fan of Home for the Holidays, but I just remember, like Thanksgiving, it's just like there's more kind of dysfunction. Maybe this is just because in our life there's more family dysfunction associated with Thanksgiving. I don't know, but there are a lot of movies.
So you mean like more than Christmas? There's more movies about dysfunctional Thanksgivings than there are dysfunctional.
Well, because Thanksgiving is so American, and Christmas is too. But
yeah.
I guess. I don't know. Thanksgiving is more I don't know. I think of that as more like the American, everyone has to, you know, if August Osage County were a holiday movie, it would be Thanksgiving.
It would be setting Thanksgiving.
Right.
All right.